And I'd like to begin the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. Welcome everyone today. I had an opportunity to chair multiple meetings when I was a county commissioner. It's a pleasure to be able to have an opportunity now at the state level with my two colleagues, Senator Mona Anderson and my good friend Senator Boquist, who is our vice chair, if I'm not mistaken.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I will be vice chair. The chair of vice, there we go. But in any case, thank you for being here today. No more bad jokes from the chair. Our first order of business this afternoon is the adoption of the committee rules, and I would entertain a motion, please.
Madam Chair, so moved.
Okay. It has been moved, and I'm assuming Senator Moses Anderson is second, so there is no disagreement. So we have officially adopted our committee rules. Now we move on to the section of the meeting where this will be largely informational. At this point in time, largely these are reports about what has been going on during the interim with Veterans Affairs, and also updates on pieces of legislation that we have passed. And this afternoon we're going to start with invited testimony. I believe we have General Caldwell and Mr. Paul Evans here from the Governor's Office, and we will be talking about the reintegration of returning Oregon National Guard members. So I would like to invite you to the podium.
Twice in one day.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Willis is here as well. That's what happens, that Mr. Willis says, that you always sit in the front, and I'm always looking at the back.
Okay.
So I apologize. And Mr. Willis is the director of the Department of Veterans Affairs, and nice to have all of you here today. And gentlemen, I would like you to choose who would like to start first.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. I'm going to turn it over to Paul because from the Governor's Office, because he's been pressed into service at five other meetings, he said, in the next hour and a half. So I said, you go first, and Jim and I will sweep up afterwards. So go ahead, Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here for the record. I am Paul Evans, Policy Advisor to Governor Kungoski for Veterans and Military Affairs. I really want to just take about 3 or 4 minutes and say some of the things about the reintegration team that they can't say for themselves, that, quite frankly, we've never needed a reintegration team as much as we need one right now. And the folks that are here and behind and are going to be testifying all throughout the day are doing everything we possibly can to work together to try to meet the needs of the folks coming back. I also want to emphasize how each of you four, in your own ways, have already done a lot, and I think that it needs to be recognized for all the kinds of things that you're doing. The committees that Bill Taylor is currently working during the interim is really filling in a piece of the pie that we had not had time to get to. The Task Force on Veteran Services was able to get 26 bills passed in the last session, thanks to your support. We had 39 recommendations, however, and there were areas we just didn't have a chance to get to. And we are all comforted and excited about the fact that we're now going in for the second phase and focusing on that nexus between criminal justice and some of the needs of our veterans that didn't get a chance to reintegrate the right way. I want to say very briefly some of the context points that are on all of our minds, and the reason that we are here talking to you today about the reintegration program as well as the efforts trying to make the nexus stronger between veterans policy and public safety policy. We now have had eight years of war. Yeah, sorry, eight wars, slip of the tongue. Two that we recognize.
I've been there.
Right. 8 wars in 1 year. Right, 52 somewhere that we don't recognize. We've had somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12,000 individual mobilizations of the Guard. We have had a situation where about 2% of the population has borne the cost of this particular eight-year struggle, with three and four tours becoming, unfortunately, pretty commonplace. We have a situation where the suicide rates, both official and unofficial, are skyrocketing to the point that the Department of the Army actually appointed a poobah to be in charge of that. And anytime a Defense Department agency admits that they need a program, they recognize that there's a problem that they can't define. And we're concerned because the impact on these folks is significant. As you know, we have about 2,500 folks overseas, the 41st Brigade Combat Team. We have 200 folks getting ready to either in preparation or en route to Afghanistan. And we have another 900 or 1,000, I know, that the general's going to talk about preparing to leave next year. The bottom line is this. We have done immense outreach. We've done a lot of good work. And I think that we are two or three steps down the road from where we were. But we have a lot of work to do. And the bottom line is we're either going to pay now or we're going to pay later. We know that there are social costs when you ignore problems, and we're putting a lot of pressure on a very few amount of people. And as the governor said after he returned from his most recent trip to Iraq and Afghanistan, this is a very important issue for the state because these folks are doing everything they can to make sure that we have what we have here. And he clearly supports these initiatives, and we look forward to working on all the different things that are going to be talked about in the future. One small little piece I want to emphasize, having not to do with legislation as much as an informational piece, General Shinseki and Senator Boquist had to hear this earlier, but Secretary of Veterans Affairs Shinseki has committed to trying to end homelessness in 5 years among veterans. I'm generally a cynic about federal programs, but I believe that the points of his program and his emphasis is genuine, and I don't know if we're going to solve it in 5 years, but I do believe we're going to make a large impact over those 5 years. And Oregon plans on being very aggressive about trying to find those opportunities to partner resources and try to make a dent on the population of veterans that are homeless in Oregon. So thank you again for the opportunity to come here and share a few thoughts. If you have any questions, otherwise I'll kind of pop to the back of the room until I have to depart. Thank you.
Alex, no questions at this time? Okay.
Madam Chairman, following kind of our template from yesterday, if it's okay with you at this time, I'd like to introduce Michelle Kachowski, who is our our family program coordinator for the Oregon National Guard. And she can explain what's in your little packet that you should have in front of you, I hope you do, and tell you a little bit about what we're doing with reintegration and preparing with, and working with families for these upcoming deployments that Paul briefly mentioned, not counting the 3,000 or so folks we already have deployed. So, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Michelle Kachowski, I'm the Oregon National Guard State Family Program Director. So I run the programs for the families of the service members, both Army and Air, who are impacted by military service, so periods of time away. We, of course, focus on the long-term deployments, so the ones we currently have in Iraq, the ones we have headed to Afghanistan, and then the two-hour meeting I was in this morning, the other service members are getting ready to go next year. So with that, I wanted to make sure everybody understands what we're doing to help prepare the families to greet those service members back. We have a plan prior to deployment, which I do believe, ma'am, you were able to take part in one of ours in Clackamas Community College earlier this year whenever we bring the families in and help educate them on their benefits. Same theory is there whenever they return from deployment. So in your handout, there is the dates that we have tentatively set for the brigade's return. We bring the families into their armory closest to them or sometimes a community college, just wherever the facility is there that houses enough people for it, and make sure that they understand their benefits. So we talk about the TRICARE medical and dental. We talk about the mental health resources available, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Labor. The reemployment options, of course, are among concerns with this group that are coming back. We also talk about tools to educate their children on the deployment and what resources we have. We try to educate the families prior to the service member actually coming back into the country so that they're prepared to greet them when they come back, that little less than 2 weeks from battlefield to the boardroom, as the comment is. They can be back that quickly, so make sure they have the information. Once they actually return, these service members and families, as you'll see from the three follow-on ones, have other events where we see them. It's the beginning of the reunion process, certainly not the end. We take this out for the first 90 days post their return, and from there we make an assessment. We will do strong bonds events, which are marriage enrichment retreats for the families, so that the service member and the spouse have a chance to actually go and spend the weekend with each other, have a strong, healthy family. We're also going to be doing the Franklin Covey 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families to try to make the families a little bit stronger, so it's not just mom and dad, but maybe mom and dad and the kids. And we're also doing the teen program of highly effective military children for the teens as well, so that we're concentrating on the whole family. Among that, we also, of course, then start the heavy referrals into the Career Transition Assistance Program, the employment program that the Oregon Military Department has, and the reintegration team. The reintegration team of Mr. Very Bertner, who's in the back of the room, the program that he works with, is all service members helping service members, so the peer-to-peer support that they have. So we refer a lot of families to the reintegration team so they can understand what's going on with their service member, hear it from a fellow service member's perspective, and then, of course, help the service members understand. We give them that peer-to-peer support through their program. Overall, it's the information that we try to give them pre-deployment and post-deployment resources for them. And a large part of it is command-driven. We know that some of our units have a little harder hit with our one unit that had casualties from the brigade and our units that have sometimes tougher missions that are out there doing convoy security. So we just change it after the 90-day mark to meet what's the need for the unit. We listen to the commander, talk to General Wyardy and Colonel Hokinson, about what they need for their families. The entire union process, which we've talked about before, is at least 6 months, sometimes up to a year, and then after that it really moves into the community resources, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the federal VA benefits. That's the longer-term issues. One of the projects that we have going on currently is in Lane County with Oregon Communities of Circle Support, and it's a federal grant through the National Center on Homelessness along with through the Walmart Foundation. So they've taken Willamette Family, and they have an outreach meeting there, and they've done a lot of training, clinical direction, and we have a follow-on call with that tomorrow to see how we can partner that around the rest of the state and also include the Oregon partnership. Under the direction of General Caldwell, we also have the idea to train, film those who are doing the training, because while we invite everybody into our meetings, not always time, place is convenient. So we're going to use the local community TV stations, the burn them to DVDs, and try to educate our families in a couple facets rather than you have to make the one afternoon, the one meeting, to give them all an option. Also put them on the Oregon Reintegration Team website and then have copies available where we know our families commonly stop in, the Tri-West Service Center office, the county veteran reps, to have a full marketing approach for our families. With that, if any questions, myself or General Caldwell, I'm sure we can answer them for you.
I'd like just to ask a clarifying question, so forgive me if for my own ignorance with this. I know that this is largely a Guard program, mm-hmm. and it was initiated by the Guard, at least my understanding, because of the differences in soft landings and how our Guard is deployed versus other branches of the military service. But my understanding is that you work across the continuum with this program, with all branches of the service with this. Could you give us some information concerning that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the primary focus, and that's how we're funded through the National Guard Bureau, is to deal with the National Guard. However, we recognized, I think early on, that it simply wasn't practical to assume that the other services, particularly Oregon as a state, is a reserve component state. We're not an active component state. We don't have an active duty base, per se, other than Umatilla Chemical Depot, which is in the process of closing. And so we really don't have any DOD operations that go 24/7 like a Fort Lewis, a McCord, Bangor, or one of these big operations. We just simply don't have it. So we saw early on that the need was there to not only just deal with National Guardsmen, but also with the other reserve components. And we didn't really anticipate it, but we did find shortly thereafter that all of a sudden we'd have a lot of active duty personnel who perhaps their families were still back in Oregon. They were deployed, and young, and particularly and normally young families, and so we certainly have not turned any of them away now. Problem being, we don't have direct access to them. We don't get fed by big Army, big Air Force, big Navy to say, Joe Pizzazz's wife is now living in Boring, Oregon. So they almost got to self-identify. But whenever they do, and we hear about it through the different groups, whether they be Jim's office or the veterans support groups that are out there and the traditional veterans organizations, then we certainly deal with it any way we can. We don't distinguish between, say, well, are you Guard or you're not. We don't operate that way. So we feel very good about that, and I think that in large part I think it's been to our benefit, because I think people have become accustomed to, we call it Fort Oregon, and we're Fort Oregon. So you got to take care of everybody that comes in the fort.
Right.
Just again a follow up, if I may, colleagues.
Your chair.
I know.
We're just along for the ride.
But I depend on both of you because of your experience and wisdom, and I'm glad I can say that on the record. In any case, one thing you said, General, that a little concern, and that is, you know, the kind folks have to self-identify.
Mm-hmm.
Is that seems to me to be a big, and Mr. Willis, you are really nodding your head as well, and that's been a concern, I think, at least with folks that I have spoken to, because oftentimes they don't know where to go.
Right.
They don't know where the point of contact is. And when you talk about reintegration, essentially, what are we doing to make sure that it isn't just self-identification? What are the processes that we're trying to put together to really market this a little more aggressively and assertively, I guess.
I'm going to let Jim have it that, because yeah. I think we see some of the active duty folks, like I said, but it's a fairly small group. Jim, on the other hand, has got a lot of veterans being turned back to Oregon, and I think he can speak to that, some of the frustrations that they've experienced.
Right, and I appreciate that, General. Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. Here's the situation that we're confronted with on a regular basis, and also some things we're doing about it. The good news is, on people separating from the service, having just completed an enlistment, let's say, or a period of service, or maybe they've done a full 20 years or 25 years, the Department of Defense regularly reports that to us based on home of record. When we get that, we send them an interactive CD, a welcome home CD. We get approximately 300 a month coming back to Oregon out of the military, active duty. Okay, so that's one group. Okay, the interactive CD has resulted in quite a few more contacts with our office than we had in the past when we did a paper booklet that we used to just mail to them. Now with the CD, and it's, of course, the change in how people get their information nowadays, they look at the CD. It has tabs they can click on. It has audio, and they can just decide, okay, what is it I want to know about, and here's the number I call, and that's how we're hearing from them. So that takes care of our people separating from the active duty forces. By working with our reintegration team and the Oregon Military Department, of course, we have little problem dealing with our Oregon Army and Air Guard. We have a very strong relationship, both post-deployment and demobilization. So that's probably where we all shine the best, is in serving our Guard personnel. The third element, however, is more problematic, and that is our active reserve components from all five branches of the service. It is not unusual, as an example, for an active-duty Coast Guard member who is a reservist, active reserve, living somewhere in Oregon, to be called up by the Coast Guard to be deployed to one of the theaters of operation, to spend their duty tour, and to return to Oregon. And at the end of the day, we didn't know they were called, and we don't know they came home. So that's true of the Air Force, it's true of the Navy, it's true of the Marine Corps, it's true of the Army. The exception is when a unit is called up at Swan Island in the Navy Reserve or the Marines who are assigned. We are told that, and we can go up and give post-deployment or pre-deployment and post-deployment briefings and brief them on their benefits and so on, just as we do with our Guard personnel. The same thing is true of our Marine engineers that are stationed out of the active reserve component in Eugene. We've done that a couple times, and they're getting ready to go again. So those are easy, but it's the ones and twos and threes that are hard. So early next month, myself and five other state directors are going to meet with Secretary Shinseki in D.C. and with some the undersecretary for the Department of the Defense for active. They have long titles, by the way, but it's Active Reserve Forces, and they have an undersecretary who does that. And we're simply going to say, look, we don't care how you notify us, but we've got to know about these people because they're entitled to the same benefits that everybody else is, but we don't know about them. And as good a website as we think we have, and as good a public presentations as we put on, and the stand downs that we hold, and I could go on and on with our outreach efforts, these people are going to fall through the cracks, and in some cases not get the disability benefits they're entitled to, the health care, and so on. As an example, when a person returns from the theater in Iraq or Afghanistan today, they are guaranteed 5 years of VA health care, okay? But they got to enroll. Yeah. We can help them do that. Now, the VA can help them as well, but they've got to know that they've got it and so on. And so we're going to work out a methodology with the DOD, Department of Defense, and if necessary, with the separate secretaries of Air Force, Army, Navy, and so on, to advise us when someone is put on orders, you know, the pre-alert deployment, and then we will notify them. And I don't care if they send me the email or home a record or whatever they send. And then we'll say, here we are, we're ready to help you, and here's the closest person to you, which might be a county veteran service officer. Doesn't necessarily have to be one of our people. Could be a county person. And they want to do this, by the way, as bad as we do. Our job every day is to serve these people, but we got to know who they are. So that right now is our biggest challenge. But I think we have turned the corner in terms of talking to the right people. If the Undersecretary for Department of Defense and the Secretary of Veterans Affairs can't get this solved, then we've got a bigger problem than I thought we did. So, but we state directors believe that that's the route we need to go.
And Michelle, I'd like Michelle to just talk a little bit about the joint family support program that she actually runs.
So, right. So in your packet, one of the flyers in there is the flyer that says Joint Family Support Assistance Program. Under the federal law, and you'll see in there the National Defense Authorization and where the program started in 2007, the Joint Family Support Assistance Program is to address that very issue. I had previously worked for the Army Reserve out of Vancouver Barracks, so I know how hard it is for our ones and twos that do go. The Joint Family Support Assistance Program team was started with that specific idea in mind to help those who are here. They really do cross all branches, all components. Their Office of the Secretary of Defense contracted employees through their companies. They are tasked with making sure they understand the Marine Reserve, the Army Reserve, Navy Reserve, all of those branches and components. Their programs there, you have the short description about them, of what they do. They really do know more of what's going on. By no means will I say it's perfect, but they at least know more of what's going on. And with that, under the new federal law, the Yellow Ribbon Program, which you've probably heard at some point, or at least the phrase out there, that also is helping us actually provide resources to those people in our state. The movement that we have going on within the military department is because of the numbers and the amount, and Mr. Bertner from the reintegration team and I were talking about this again on the way over, is having area meetings around the state on set weekends of the month. So if it's the second weekend in Eugene, the third weekend in La Grande, for anybody from any branch or component to come in there to see the many services that we have offered so that we can do a better outreach and some continuity for where they're at. Through the Joint Family Support Assistance Program, they do reach a lot of those, and then we are trying to make sure we have a better handle on it. And we still do have ones and twos within the military department that go out that we try to handle that are individual offers, or they volunteered, or they have a special skill that needs to go. So we're trying to figure out a better solution for advertising it. And with that same note, I'm going to point out one of the things that we do is we do cross-market all the time. We have materials in Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. We hand out theirs. We put them in the Tri-West office, because if you're a military family, you're going to enroll in that military medical insurance, most likely. You're going to go in to get an ID card. So all of those normal spots where we're going to see those families, we plaster our materials there so that we can help them identify. And the last point with the same idea is Oregon and Washington have a great partnership in trading families back and forth across the border, if you will. We have so many people that live in one state and belong to another. We actually have a joint quarterly meeting called the Inter Service Family Assistance Committee, ISFAC, and it's all of the family support people from branches and components from Washington and Oregon. So we make a lot of referrals back and forth. So if we do have a Navy family here that is deploying, Navy Region Northwest will actually call us, call me, and let me know that that they're in our area and they're deploying. So we still have a ways to go, and I'm thrilled to hear that, but we're making good strides. We have some of those key partnerships going to help those families. And everybody knows that it's a joint program. Not home is not home to the spouse. It doesn't matter if you're the spouse of a Navy person or the mom of a soldier and you need the assistance and you live in this state or you belong to the state in any fashion, we're going to help you. That is our mission. Thank you.
I might add that, as Michelle indicated, this came out in 2007. Mm-hmm. We started our reintegration team in 2004, if you remember correctly, out of a need that we recognized.
Absolutely.
With one of our large battalions that had been sent to Iraq, and we were basically building this bicycle while we rode it, because we didn't really have a template to work off of, and we just had to try to figure it out. Resources have started to come in since about 2007, and I think we've done a better job, but there is still a requirement. There is no system that sets up that says, you know, Sergeant Pazatz from USAR or active duty is now deployed and his wife is back in Portland, Oregon. We don't have that. There's no, the sophistication isn't there. So we have to do these, I guess, interrelationship skills in order to keep these bonds going. Former member of your staff, Senator, who's put together several outreach meetings of different groups, and there are a tremendous number of good, well-meaning groups that do a lot of good work. But, and I would hate to try to list them. I don't know that I could come up with them all, but Michelle's been able to pull them together and keep them coming to meetings. And there's a lot of crosstalk that happens in those situations where we find out things that we wouldn't have known otherwise because of those relationships, as opposed to having a system that would say, you know, boom, email pops up this morning and Lieutenant Colonel Brian Boquist just got deployed to Somalia. You know, we would never know that unless Brian put a press release out. But that's the only way you'd know those sort of things, because the system isn't going to tell us. So we got to find out through other means.
No, I'd like to build on this notion of a system, if we may, because it seems as if you do have a system here within the construct of the military. And you just mentioned, General, that what we're dealing with out there, and this is where I know Michelle Davison is in the audience today, and she has helped pull together a number of meetings of folks from across the continuum from the public sector and the private sector, nonprofit sector, other partnerships. And it has worked in a number of areas, in particular our team Clackamas. I know Lane County seems to have a pretty robust program going where not only is it your construct, but it's pulling in these other partnerships. And I'm trying to give you folks an opening to talk a little bit. We had a meeting recently on reintegration, which we believed, we hoped, was the next step in this process of building a statewide system, also involving these other partnerships. And I was hopeful that in the last few minutes of your time here, we could talk a little bit about some of the preliminary for my colleagues to know what we started to spaghetti we started to throw on the wall of how we really move this into a systems-wide state approach that's kind of consistent across the state. So,
well, Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and comment on what I took away from that. And what I believe Madam Chair is talking about is one of the three task forces that came out of the Governor's Veterans Services Task Force report. And the one specifically she's talking about is the Reintegration Task Force, which met on Friday, November 13th, and is scheduled to meet again on Thursday, December 3rd. The key component that came out of that last meeting for me was setting up veterans networks on a regional basis around the state, involving both traditional and non-traditional partners that maybe people hadn't thought about before that actually can bring something to the table for these returning veterans and their families. And the model or the blueprint for this what's sometimes called a regional vet net or vet network does not necessarily have the same partners in the same regional area depending on what the need of the group of the veteran and their family are. But when they build it themselves based on their local need, what we're finding based on the model we first looked at, which was the Lane County VetNet, which is probably the senior one in the state, They learned early on when they first started, we've got this many people at the table, but now we need this many more. It's very similar to what happened when we built the state reintegration team. We've added more and more and more people to that, to where now when we meet, it's several hundreds of people that all bring something to the table to help the group. What we want to do is replicate that on a smaller level all around the state. And I think when the reintegration task force completes its final report, which I believe is due to this body in October of 2010, with interim reports in between, that the core value of where it's going is going to be the creation of those regional veteran networks. And I'm very encouraged by that. That's going to involve a lot more people, and it will keep people from pointing to Salem, to the big reintegration team, saying, well, that's their job, that's what they do. Well, we can't possibly do it. Just like Michelle commented a moment ago, yes, she's the statewide director of that family assistance program, but they've got those assistance team leaders in every armory. Yep. It's regional all over the state. We should do that with reintegration all over the state. So that's, Madam Chair, what I took away from the very early. We've only had the one meeting, but right. I was very excited about that. I thought that was a very good outcome.
Question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess two questions for General Caldwell. Have the feds funded this through October of next year, so the brigade's going to get service? That's the first question. And the second question is, okay, who or what's on the docket going to the mountains now?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, indeed, we are funded through this fiscal year. It's right now, as you know, we're on a continuing resolution from the federal government. The NDAA passed, but the appropriations bills have not passed. So we're basically working on the percentage. I think it's, what, 25% of the total of last year, of what you got last year. So we don't anticipate any funding hiccups with respect to the teams that we have together right now. The other good news story as far as funding goes is that presently there are two marks, one in the Senate, one in the House, that Congressman, former Senator Schrader helped get in the House, and Senator Wyden got in the Senate version of the appropriations bill. In that was, depending on which one you want, one I think was 600,000, 700,000, I can't remember the number, but the one in the Senate was 400,000. So we're anticipating that there are going to be some additional resources come in. Those resources are going to be earmarked for reintegration activities, and one of the primary issues that we're going to approach with that money is both work with Oregon Partnership on the suicide hotline. We've noticed, according to their statistics, which is primarily the go-to place here in Oregon for all people, but particularly service members, their numbers have gone up on the order of like 20, 25, 22%, something like that, in calls from veterans. So we're going to use some of those resources to help robust that program. And the other things we plan to do with those is, as Michelle mentioned earlier, about, you know, we know that we can put on a good presentation with good, smart, certified, smart people that'll tell you what to look for and say PTSD signs or suicide signs and those sort of things. But we also know with 3,000 family members plus, we got roughly 3,000 people deployed, so you know you've got at least 3,000, probably closer to 4,500 or 6,000 different family members out there that probably don't have a lot of time to stop what they're doing. We've never had that many people in a presentation. So we want to get these opportunities where we can hire professional companies to come in and film these activities, these seminars, these opportunities to learn, and then capture that, as she indicated, on websites, on CDs, on community TV channels, any way we can to get this information out. So if a working spouse can't be at the armory on a Saturday morning at 10 o'clock because of soccer, work, whatever the case may be, maybe that night they can go on the website, hit that website, and get that same information. That's our goal in a rough sense. We think this money will help us get there from here, and we can do this statewide then. We can have access to all of our families statewide as opposed to just the 25 or 30 that show up inside of that particular presentation, wherever it may be. So that's, we're real excited about that opportunity. I think the future, as we look at the future, this is, I don't see this ending anytime soon. I think Congress has stepped up rather belatedly, perhaps, in our case, but they did finally start stepping up to recognize that we need these kind of resources here in the local communities, particularly for states like Oregon, who do not have a major military facility in their boundary. And I think we're a classic example of that, and we're one of the very few that really end up in that particular situation. So I anticipate that we're going to see this continue on. I hope, cross my fingers and hope that as this winds down, and assumably it will someday, then we won't just forget about this aspect of our society and then be back where we were, say, 10 years ago when we were trying to ramp up. Does that answer your question?
Second half of the question. Who else is going?
Who else is going to be deploying? We have the 3rd Battalion, 116th, who's going to be deployed with the 116th. We don't have the exact date. We've got the alert order. It should happen sometime before October of next year. We also have our aviation unit out of Pendleton, CH-47s. That company had deployed to Iraq, if you recall, or Afghanistan, and actually had some casualties where we lost a helicopter and a crew over there. They're going back. And then we have an engineer, part of our engineer battalion, that will also be deploying. We don't have the exact numbers on that, but I think it's somewhere around 250, 300 people. So we're anticipating in the next year that we'll have roughly 2,600, 2,700 soldiers coming home from the 41st Brigade, and we'll be putting out the door roughly 1,200 more. So it'll be... And I think the numbers Jim indicated right now, we're around 13,000 individual deployments from the start of this activity until now, and we don't see anything in the horizon that's telling us it's going to end anytime soon.
And follow up, I'd like to just ask a quick question. I'm assuming with these numbers that a number of these folks are multiple deployments.
Oh, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Having its own sets of issues because of pretty much coming back, trying to get back into
life.
Normal life, mm-hmm. and then again being sent to a war zone. And
yep.
So we're seeing some interesting harmful effects. I've heard.
I think the last time we did a statistical analysis, it was on the order of 40%. I think it was 46 or 47%, if my memory serves me correct, of the deployment with the 41st Brigade were at least one previous deployment. We had somewhere around 100 and some folks that were on their third or fourth deployment. So that out of 2,600 isn't a lot, but yet that does give you an indication. We also know that the folks that are over there right now, we're at roughly the average has been, believe it or not, around 30% of these folks are leaving here unemployed. There's around 37, 38% of the group that's over there right now that consider themselves not to have a job when they get back. If I remember right, the number we just saw last week's around 400 have indicated that they would consider redeploying with one of these other units that are going out next year. No, it was 283. Wasn't it?
This morning, the number was about 280.
Okay, 283 people have indicated already that are in Iraq right now that they would come home, have a short respite, and then redeploy because they don't have work. So I think we've got a great team set up here in Oregon through Jim's department, through the employment department, to try to assist our soldiers. We've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 different employers who have offered to be on our job page, if you will, but there just aren't any jobs. Mm-hmm. If they have the jobs, they'll hire them, but we haven't had the jobs, so I think is going to be our biggest challenge.
I think also, Madam Chair, if
excuse me,
I didn't want to interrupt Senator Boquist if he had a comment, but this is why the fruits of House Joint Memorial 4 from the last session that asked for the 90-day soft landing is so important. And currently pending before the U.S. Congress is H.R. 3358 and its Senate companion bill, which is Senate Bill 1426. And I spoke with Senator Wyden on Veterans Day, and he said two things are holding things up. One, of course, is the health care debate, which has kind of stymied everything back in D.C. right now. But the second one is the cost of doing this on a national basis, which is like $10 million a year for 10 years, $100 million. Doesn't sound a lot when you're talking federal budget, but you know, when you're $12 trillion in debt, it's a lot of money. So he said maybe we are not going to be able to get the full 90 days. My point in telling you this is on these multiple deployments where we're still bringing people back and we're cutting them loose from, in some cases, literally trigger pulling to release in 14 days is not healthy, and especially if they've been deployed multiple times. And we're seeing it in domestic issues, divorce, violence, those kinds of things. We're seeing it in issues like debt, you know, financial management issues and so on. Then the mental health issues associated with it, and it just goes on and on and on. We have got to have some time when these people come home, well, they're on Title 10 orders and guaranteed a paycheck, so they're not worried about the finances. And then we visit with, and the general and others at the military department, visit with the officers and senior NCOs and say, okay, who do we need to work with here? And that's where Michelle's folks come in, too, because this bill, it targets physical and mental health evaluations, employment counseling and assistance, marriage and family counseling, marriage enrichment kinds of things, financial management, as I mentioned before, educational and trades counseling for vocational training, for those who mm-hmm. want to be a welder or an electrician or something like that. Also, counseling and education with regard to their VA benefits. And if we had that window of time and they were meeting in an armory setting or with the fellows and men and women who they just came back from the combat zone with, I think they're going to be far more willing to either self-disclose or to work with the counselors that are there for any number of these issues. So I'm really hoping that, you know, if we could get 30 days paid, I mean, I'd rather see more, but right now we're not getting the time we need with these folks. And, I mean, that's active duty as well. It isn't just the Guard folks, but it's all of them. And the difference with active duty, and Mike mentioned Fort Oregon a moment ago, and I agree with that analogy, when the active duty folks come back, they're coming back to a Fort Lewis, yeah. you know, or they're coming back to Fort Benning or wherever. They've got a support unit all around them, all built around them. We don't have that, and we need that time with these people. So when we talk reintegration, we've got to talk about this as well, the giving us the additional time to work with these soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and so on.
Madam Chair, I'll just add, the governor who just went to Iraq and Afghanistan and just got back, and he gave a press release or a press opportunity here, I think it was last week or maybe it was this week, I can't remember now, but within the last 7 days, let's say. He indicated when he talked to town hall groups of soldiers that there was some fascinating things came about in that discussion, and the soft landing legislation was one of those. And he also went with other governors from Wyoming and Alabama, or Mississippi, I guess it was.
Mississippi, yeah.
Mississippi, and he talked about how Oregon soldiers were asking these rather complicated and technical-type questions and certain aspects of this thing, where the other guys were saying, well, what about my driver's license and what about my hunting license? And so I don't know if that means that we've been doing this a long time or maybe we've done a better job of educating our people or getting information to them, but I think there's a lot of concern. I think what it tells us is there's a lot of concern from these folks in the you know, about what happens when I get home. The governor, of course, emphasized to all of them that this is a grand opportunity for everybody to take advantage of the new GI Bill, which is very robust and has some very good components to it, even for reservists and guardsmen. And I think you know, not to get off the subject of reintegration, but this is an integral part of it, is what Jim just mentioned about trade schools, about skills building, and about, you know, higher education or more education, you know, post-secondary high school education. My concern is that I read the newspaper, as you do, and I see that, you know, the Central Oregon Community College is bulging at the seams and can't take any more students. All of these different community colleges, that, what do we have, 17 of them out here in the state, the universities, everybody's maxed to the gills. And that bothers me a little bit. I don't know what the solution is, but I think from your standpoint in this body, I think that's something that we're going to have to get our arms around, to make sure that we have seats for these potential students. Clearly, they're going to have money from the federal government behind them to take advantage of that. We're encouraging that at every level that we can, and to the point now where I've had several phone conversations with Colonel Hokeson, and I've tried to impress upon him, and I know they're working it, to try to get some sort of a feeling of where these soldiers are going, what they're going to do post-deployment. Mm-hmm. You know, what is their desire to do? And if they are desirable, if their desire is to go to school, change their habits, or change their schools or their career, then let's try to identify that now and see what we got to work on so we can actually start that process before they get home. And he's working it right now. It's a little difficult to do when you're scattered all over Iraq and trying to stay alive every day. But nonetheless, there are times when they can do that. And he said that they're gonna really plow ahead hard to find out, try to distinguish who wants to go to school, who wants to go to work, who wants to redeploy, who wants to do what. Because I think that's going to be important for us to kind of understand how big this element is before we come to you and say we need X, Y, or Z until we know what the situation is. So we're trying to identify how big the elephant is right now.
Thank you for that. I'm going to remind us we are actually a little bit over with your presentation, which is fine because I think the information is critical for us to have. And I'm just going to, again, colleagues, any other questions at this point in time? I am going to ask our committee administrator to do some homework based on your last comments. And number one, evidently there was a program at one time in the state, or I've heard, that actually helped incentivize employers to hire veterans. And evidently, there were dollars attached to that, and we don't have to discuss it now, but I would like to get that information and get some history if indeed that program existed, despite the fact that we are in economic crunch time. I still don't think that's bad information to have. And the other piece is I think we also need to look at the skill sets that our military folks are bringing back, and we need to have some consistency, in my opinion, and I'm going to wax eloquent a little bit here, across the system, community college and higher ed, about what credits are given, when, where, when, and how. So when folks enter into the system, you know, perhaps we can open up seats if we can get folks in a little quicker and not just give them 3 credits for PE, but credits, which evidently happens, but also opportunities based on the fact that they have significant skill sets after being in the military and being in the field. So I'd like to get that on the record, that longer term, if not in February, but in the future, I think that these are a couple of issues.
Yes, ma'am. And just let me comment that we have learned, without a doubt, that a lot of these young men and women, they go off for this deployment. They do not see themselves coming back to a minimum wage hamburger job when we've entrusted them with life and death making decision powers and being in charge of other people, both domestic people that are there and their own soldiers. They cannot come back and do what they did before. So we have to figure out a way to get them retrained and get them into a meaningful employment to stop that frustration, stop that homelessness, stop that reliance on alcohol and drugs after the fact, because I think a lot of that is connected.
Frustrations.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Willis, General Caldwell. Michelle, it's great to have you here today.
Always a pleasure.
And I tell you, we look forward to continue our work with
Thank
you.
Thank you for your support.
So let's try and get back on time here. And at this point, I have on our agenda the Oregon State Bar's Military Assistance Panel. And I'm going to apologize if I do not say this name correctly. Jerry Gatos?
Perfect.
Great. Jeff Barton, Charles Williams, and you are the founding members of the Military Assistance Panel. Okay, thank you. Sorry, Charlie Williams could not make it, so we have you two gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, thank you for having us. I'm Jerry Gatos. I practice law in Eugene, and I'm current president of the Oregon State Bar and pleased to be here. Some of you have heard before, so I will hopefully be exactly the same. But I'm appearing on behalf of about 14,000 members. We're what's called a mandatory bar, and it's an organization that if you want to practice law in the state, you have to belong to. We're a self-supporting and self-regulating profession. We license and discipline lawyers. We speak for the legal profession and provide various services to the public. In the public service part is what we're here to talk about today, and then in particular the military assistance panel. And Jesse Barton will speak in certainly more detail than I can. He's just been an astounding volunteer and someone who has driven the program, so we appreciate his efforts. But he's just an example of the type of lawyers that we have in our state. On a personal note, I was an assistant staff judge advocate in the Air Force during Vietnam. I did not go to Vietnam. I got to be in Michigan and Montana, which were wonderful places, and then allowed me to come to Oregon. So I appreciate the Air Force and also appreciate the fact that these reintegration programs are extremely important. I was on Strategic Air Command bases, and so there are a lot of people that would be deployed for 6 months to Guam and then would come back, and they would then be deployed a short time thereafter again. And there was a lot of family counseling, disruption, reintegration issues that we tried to handle on the base. But this, what I've heard today just is, I'm truly proud of the state of Oregon and the work that you're doing. So thank you for that. We want to ensure that service members' rights are protected, and we do that in a variety of ways. The Military Assistance Panel is the major way. We have a website, which is part of the way that people can find this assistance, and it's a good place to start and acquaint yourself with the Oregon State Bar and the breadth of services that the bar has. While the legal information provided on that website is not legal advice, it provides people with legal problems a place to begin thinking about their alternatives. The Military Assistance Panel is one of the free or pro bono services that members of the bar provide to the public. We have an aspirational standard of 80 hours of uncompensated service for the public good each year. Between 20 and 40 hours of those are supposed to be directly to the direct services to the poor. In 2008, about 1,989 members reported providing over 163,000 hours of pro bono services. And since reporting is voluntary, we're relatively well convinced that there's a lot more pro bono that goes on, and we're appreciative of our bar members for doing that. We also have what we refer to as a lawyer referral service, so you can either get that by going to the bar website, or you can call an 800 number, and we'll be there'll be an answer, someone will answer and then talk to you about lawyers available in your area who can assist in those particular areas. We also have what we refer to as a modest means panel, and the modest means panel is lawyers who are willing to charge less than their hourly rate to assist people who are capable of paying, and we just remodeled that program a little to actually allow greater participation in that program, because before we did not allow folks, if they had a home, that was generally enough of an asset that they couldn't participate in modest means. That qualification is now gone, and so it's a much better program. Plus, there's a sliding scale so that more people can get involved. So those who return and have the capability of paying can get those modest means programs. Lawyers also do every year have what's called Campaign for Equal Justice, and the past couple of years have raised about $1 million to assist in funding legal aid. And we want to thank the legislature for the general fund dollars last time for going for legal aid. We know that we're only meeting about 20%, about 20% of the need, and that's about 80% of the needs going unmet. And in some of the counties that you have talked about, we have great, much higher levels of need on those legal aid sides. So, and we know that obviously veterans will participate to some extent in those programs. So I leave the description of the military assistance panel to Jesse, but I'm particularly proud of the bar's role in having that panel and also bringing forth legislation in the last session that provided service members remedies if a company ignores its obligations under the Federal Service Member Members Civil Relief Act. Earlier this month, the Board of Bar Governors, which is the organization that I'm president of, we passed a resolution on the occasion of Veterans Day extending gratitude to those who have served and condolences to those who have lost loved ones, and we intend to do that on an annual basis. We view the military assistance panel, however, as the way we can translate that sentiment into some action. Again, thank you for your time, and Jesse Barton will assist in further.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney. Actually, I'm an Army veteran, a lawyer in private practice here in Salem, and I've been a member of the military assistance panel since 2003. And since 2007, I've served as the panel's legislative contact. I was actually asked to talk about two things to this committee. Mr. Williamson was going to talk about the sort of the history of the assistance panel, but he's unable to be here this afternoon, so I'm going to do my best to fill in for him on that role. Then I wanted to talk about some legislation that the panel was, I think, instrumental in getting passed, and some of the things that the bar is working on now and further assisting veterans and service members. The panel was formed in 2000. Well, actually, what it was there was this recognition, which you've heard discussed today by, particularly by General Caldwell, about how this is Fort Oregon. We don't have a big military base with a large judge advocate general office in it where service members can go get legal assistance when they need it. We just didn't have that sort of thing. When the nation first went to war, when we first deployed troops, our JAG office was consisted of Major Mark Ronning. And that was it, one guy, one major. And as a matter of fact, he's in Iraq right now with the 41st Brigade. Since that time, since 2003, the JAG office has expanded. There are several people working there now, not a whole team of folks, but there's a lot more than just Major Ronning. But in any event, there was a recognition that there wouldn't be enough attorneys in that JAG office to help the folks when they came back from those initial deployments, which ended back in 2004. And so this idea came forward from, came from former Chief Justice Wally Carson and former Attorney General Hardy Myers and his Chief Deputy Pete Shepard. I actually think this was Pete Shepard's idea, was to form this panel, try to get a lot of bar members to volunteer to work for service members to help them with their legal issues when they return from deployment or whenever the need arises. And at that time, Charlie Williamson was bar president. When he stepped down as president, he was asked to take over or to assume the chairmanship of an advisory committee that oversaw the creation and expansion of the military assistance panel. I had the pleasure of serving as a member of that committee, and we did, I think, a lot of really good work over the panel. Ran for about 2 years. We now have about 125 members. We probably handled a total of 450 cases in all. What panel members agree to do is to handle cases for 2 hours pro bono, meaning for free, and to help the service member with whatever legal issue they have. And that might be relevant to their military service, of course. And then, it's our understanding. I mean, most of us that have done any type of panel cases, we don't stop after 2 hours. I mean, you're halfway into a case and you're done 2 hours, you don't say, well, that's it, you have to pay me now or something like that. You just finish the case. And that's what historically has happened. And I think that of the cases that have come through the door, I think Charlie Williamson probably made this point this morning before the Joint Judiciary Committee, of the cases that the panel members have handled that were bona fide cases, all of those cases got handled from beginning to end by the panel member rather than just somebody stopping after just 2 hours. The predominant area that we work in is in the area of something called the Federal Service Members Civil Relief Act, the SCRA. And on my written materials, page 3 is a summary that David Niebel of the Bar's Public Affairs staff put together, which just summarizes some of the key features of the SCRA. And I wanted to talk about a couple of those as I go through this. But the one point I like to make, I always want to make when I talk about the SCRA, is for folks to understand that the SCRA isn't a benefit like a veteran's benefit, like a home loan program or a educational benefit. What it is it's a national defense feature. The idea is to relieve persons when they go on to active duty and they're going to be deployed in a combat zone, for example, relieve them of concern over things like interest rates on their credit cards or lawsuits that might be filed against them or might already have been filed against them or leases that they might have signed on to that for a home, for example, or a car that they no longer have any need for because they're going to be on active duty. SCRA allows for termination of leases. It allows for reductions of interest rates on consumer credit from whatever the interest rate is to no more than 6%. The idea allows for stays of civil actions, civil lawsuits pending the deployment. And so the idea is that when the service member is on active duty, he can focus his attention on his service, on his active duty service, on his military service, rather than worrying about civilian things like interest rates and lawsuits, leases, things of that nature. The Bar's done a lot of training of bar members in this SCRA area. It's put together what's now an online training program for attorneys who would like to join the panel. Just a couple, three weeks ago, the Bar, in conjunction with Willamette University College of Law, had a training session on the SCRA. It was very well attended and was designed primarily to try to attract more attorneys onto the panel, and particularly family law attorneys, because as I was actually one of the speakers at that particular program, and what we see is that the length of this war, the multiple deployments, has taken a real toll on the family units of our service members. So the panel's biggest need for attorneys or these volunteer attorneys is in the area of family law, dealing with everything from child custody to divorce cases, whatever. That was probably the biggest motivation for me anyway to work on that conference or the program that we recently had over at Willamette Law School, was to try to get some family law practitioners more family law practitioners onto the panel. And also we need to find more practitioners from the state's rural areas. We have, this is Fort Oregon, as General Caldwell says. We have service members all over the state. One of the 41st Brigade's infantry battalions doesn't have a single company that's in the Willamette Valley. They're scattered all over the state. So we need to have probably more attorneys from outside the Willamette Valley than we have right now, because we have more service members from outside the Willamette Valley than I think we do lawyers. That kind of concludes what I wanted to say. Although we actually do, the Bar's done some other things I did want to mention really quickly. One of the things I had the pleasure of doing about a year and a half ago was organizing a day-long program that the Bar sponsored at its own expense to train attorneys in the area of practice on veterans' disability claims. That was back in, I think, March of 2008. And then just last August, the Bar had another half-day-long program on training lawyers on representing today's combat veterans, is what the name of the program was. It was Representing Today's Combat Veterans. Very good program, explaining the unusual or the unique characteristics of our current war effort, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, things of that nature that attorneys will run across in a general way whenever they represent persons who've been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan during this current war effort. That was a general program. It's served as sort of a spur to have a more focused program on representing service members who get embroiled in the criminal and juvenile justice systems. Some of the speakers from the Bar's program from last August, which were primarily folks from the Veterans Administration Hospital up in Portland, are going to be speakers at that particular this conference we have coming up on the criminal and juvenile justice issue cases. General Caldwell will be a speaker at that conference, as will Captain Brian Leibel of the Bar's JAG office. That will be held on February 27th at the Anderson Readiness Center here in Salem. I see my materials say Portland, but it's in Salem. That's completes what I would consider an overview of the Bar's program on the Military Assistance Panel and its ongoing efforts to train its attorney members on representing service members. Wanted to talk briefly about the panel's legislative effort from the last legislative session. This actually was something that came out of an informational hearing that Representative Barker had in House Veterans Affairs in February of 2008. The idea was to put some teeth in the Service Member Civil Relief Act. We've seen, members of the panel have seen many cases where a service member might have small chunks of money, relatively small chunks of money at issue regarding, for example, credit card companies' refusal to lower interest rates to the 6% maximum. And maybe he's got a few thousand dollars at stake, and it would cost him tens of thousands of dollars to litigate the issue. And what came out of the meeting for the informational hearing that Representative Barker held was the idea of having legislation authorizing the award of attorney fees in the event that somebody had to litigate their SCRA rights. After that meeting, a member of the Military Assistance Panel's Advisory Committee, Velda Rogers, formed an ad hoc committee that met frequently, met several times. We drafted what eventually became House Bill 2303, which this body passed in the last legislative session. There was a lot of support for it. We state bars, public affairs staffers, Susan Graby and David Niebel helped a great deal on that. General Caldwell was of great help. Paul Evans from the governor's office was of great help, and Greg Warnock from the Oregon War Veterans Association. All these folks came together and got the bill passed. The bill provides for remedies for SCRA violations in addition to attorney fees. It provides for remedies of $1,000 minimum up to treble damages for willful violations of a service member's SCRA rights. We think it's the only law of its type in the nation. If it's not the only law, it's certainly the first law of its type in the nation, and it's worked really well. One of the things I do is legislative contact for the military assistance panel. I send emails around. We have a listserv that folks can access to get information, answers to questions if they run across a difficult or a tricky legal question for a service member they're representing. And the other day I posted an email just to ask if anybody's used House Bill 2303. It's been on the books since May, and it applies to SCRA violations committed since May 8th when the governor signed the bill. I sent an email around, and I got a response back from First Lieutenant James Gardner, who's with the 41st Brigade in Iraq, and he says, I've used House Bill 2303 many times since May. I've not used the bill to secure damages or attorney fees, but have used it as a threat to creditors. Out of the 3,000-plus deployed Oregon soldiers down in Iraq, he's had 54 problems. He's had 54 soldiers come to him with SCR violation situations. He says, typically what I do then is, I send a letter to the creditor indicating that House Bill 2303 provides for a private state cause of action for the violation of the SCRA and attorney fees, damages, and all of the other things that it does. And as a result, of the 54 service members who've come to me with problems, the threat of using House Bill 2303 has worked in the service members' favor 100% of the time. So this bill was really an unmitigated success, and I think it's something that certainly this legislature can be very proud of. Mm-hmm. And that concludes my remarks. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a comment because your service isn't done, because we need more help from you. in another committee, which I don't know, maybe at some time Bill will share with the chair, we're working on two issues, and I think these are not unfamiliar. The first one is identifying veterans, and that's the issue of being able for them to voluntarily have on their driver's license a veteran mark so that we know that. And I'll come back to that and the importance of that. The second thing is the whole discussion, and there seems to be some opposition to that, not in the Senate but in the House. Hmm. The second thing is the issue of a diversion program on the I'll just say, without getting into judicial, on the light criminal side,
right.
And the constitutionality of that. And what we really need is the bar and the justice system to weigh in and identify and say that, okay, here's the parameters you can operate within a diversion program. And I think, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me, the importance of that is that we're in an unprecedented historical time. We have never before in the history of this country deployed so many soldiers in a judge and jury relationship ever before. The question came up this morning and said, well, what about Vietnam? What about World War II? We are holding soldiers that are on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq to a higher level of political correctness that's ever been attempted, probably in modern or in the Western world. So you have an 18 or 19-year-old who's going out there and they're trained to make a snap decision in the streets of some place and be judge and jury. If they're wrong, they're prosecuted by the military system and they go to Leavenworth. And so frankly, you got the ages of 18 to 22 mm-hmm. who are wired just about as tight as a piano wire can get. And we have taught them, and I use it this morning, you know, from Van Steuben and Valley Forge through drill and ceremony. We don't do drill and ceremony for parades. We do it for they react and do exactly what they're trained to do. Mm-hmm. The problem we're facing now, in a much growing need right now, and we're going to be hammered right between the eyes starting in the middle of May of next year, is these individuals are going to come back, and they're going to continue to come back in larger numbers now, and they have been judge and jury in the streets of foreign countries. Oh. And they've also been taught by doctrine not to trust any of the official authorities in either of these two countries, not to trust the police, and that the police are totally corrupt. And so what we're seeing now is we have individuals come back from, less so from the National Guard, because the National Guard comes back in a block, but from these 200 to 300 active component people coming back, entering the criminal justice system. And they're entering it because they're going down the street, something's happening, and the example that was used earlier this morning, which is true, is that, you know, when you get a traffic jam over there, it ain't road rage. It's as if you don't move, you're dead. And so these individuals snap, they react, and they get a contact with the criminal justice system. And it's because we as a nation has trained them to do X, Y, and Z, to do these reactions. Because they may have just gotten out and they don't carry DD-214 with them, they aren't identifiable presently to law enforcement. So law enforcement treats them first as a common criminal instead of what it is. It's post-traumatic stress, period, in the largest scale in the history of this country. And those individuals aren't identified. And so what we need to be able to do in the February session, and there is a move afoot to do this, best I could tell.
Yes, there is.
But there, I recognized opposition when I saw it from the House this morning right off the bat, is we've got to be able to identify these members to the police on a voluntary basis so that they can have their ID cards when they come back, their driver's license marked. And then we've got to be able to have the capability of stop them short of the criminal justice system and put them into programs like this mm-hmm. so that we can bring them back into the mainstream before they go over the other end. I'd also close out with saying that it's not just a small problem. We heard testimony of Bill, I think I'm wrong, 40% of the homeless in the state of Oregon are veterans. Is that the number we heard this morning?
Chief members of the committee, we heard that there were about 13,000 homeless in the state and 7,000 are veterans,
right.
With a significant majority of them being post-Vietnam.
Right, and we got to solve this problem, because I hate to say this because I'm a veteran, but you can't have that amount of quantity of people outside the system
right.
and maintain stability. And so I would ask the bar, I mean, there are two issues right there that I see problems. One is identifying that a diversion program is constitutional. The second thing, the assistance in getting a volunteer program to drive us so we can identify these people. Because these kids are going to come back, and we've had them being judge and jury in the streets of foreign countries. And as soon as they see a police officer, they go to, in a problem situation here, they go to exactly what they were trained to do, and that is he's corrupt and right down the line. And it is a major problem that is already leading to violent situations in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Senator Boquist. And I'd just like to add briefly that part of the testimony today is going to be dealing with veterans in the criminal justice system, as well as identification using driver's licenses. And I will also ask you, and I know Senator Mona Sanderson will join me, we would like your help with this. I hope there isn't significant resistance. However, I think that
sure
we have...
Like
we
it.
Have
It sure looked like it.
Well, let me just get on the record right now, on film, with my colleagues, that we will be quite persistent on this side of the building to do what's appropriate for our veterans. And I, for one, would welcome those challenges, and I think that we'll prevail.
Madam Chair, I think we're fine in the Senate. We can prevail there. We just need to convince some select member of House members to get this thing.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could...
just interject for just a couple of quick points. I'll be very, very fast with it. I think that I do recognize we talk about the diversion program that Senator Boquist brought up. That could be seen as a benefit, a special thing set aside for veterans, just like an educational program is or just like a home loan program is. So I think that it's important to look at that constitutional question and make sure that there's really not a problem there. But I do think that at the final analysis, we're going to determine that there's not a problem there. If there is a problem there, then our home loan program needs to be shut down and the other programs that are available fellows have to be shut down, too, because it's the same argument already made against all of those.
So it would be a domino effect.
That would be horrible.
Great.
But there is a thing called police discretion. You know, I mean, how many times, I mean, I've been stopped by police before, and the police officer lets me go, doesn't give me the speeding ticket that maybe I should have gotten. But maybe a police officer would stop somebody and think there's a situation here, I'm going to have to make an arrest, and sees the person's a veteran. He sees that on that driver's license and thinks maybe there's something more here than what I normally meets the eye. I hadn't thought of it that way until Senator Boquist until you brought it up like that.
And then they and the district attorneys and the judiciary can refer them to someone who can help them versus us making them a criminal statistic, which costs us an absolute fortune, and we've lost the benefit of the veteran.
I know that Mr. Taylor wanted to add to
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill will be, both of these bills will be introduced by this committee. One relates to a diversion program, the other one relates to licenses. And through the process, I put a memo together to Legislative Council's office. I talked to Josh Naspy, who will be the draft of the bill. We both discussed the issue of constitutionality, equal protection, privileges and immunities, whether you're benefiting one class over another, and then to do so, there's constitutional issues like rational basis. Mr. Barton has already mentioned we have a home loan program. We have other benefits that go to veterans and don't go to the average citizen, school programs, things like that. He mentioned to me a U.S. Supreme Court case. My assumption is that when we get the draft, we'll probably get a memo from Legislative Council's office in their opinion as it relates to draft. If we weren't going to get it, we will now. the other issue is that these things are always litigated. You as members cannot get into paralysis because someone says it may be unconstitutional. We would probably wouldn't pass too much legislation out of the Judiciary Committee as it relates to criminal laws. And having said that, okay, it'll be challenged through the courts. Maybe there'll be someone who's not a veteran who'll say, gee, I'm not getting this benefits, and I'm therefore going to challenge it. Okay, 5 or 6 years from now, if you go down the road and they're right, I guess the bottom line is we open it up to everyone, but it's still the discretion of the district attorney. Mm-hmm. And one of the many things that any district attorney, and you'll hear from Elizabeth Cuthbert later, is they look at the total record of the person before them. So if you have someone who is a veteran who's been in a traumatic situation, they're going to take that into consideration. They can do that now in an informal way, and they do that now. We cannot run a criminal justice system without district attorneys and police officers having discretion. So,
since Mr. Taylor, you added this piece, would you mind, and we are a little bit out of sequence, but since we're on the topic, I think we ought to just roll with it. These two concepts were really pulled together by a number of folks. If you could describe that meeting, they had expertise in the field of working with veterans issues. So perhaps you could just give us a little background on that.
Sure, Mr. Really quickly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, last August I received a email from Paul Evans, who forwarded an email from Jack Heim of the Federal Veterans Administration to me about an issue, and I talked to my chairs of the Judiciary Committees about it, and about the issue of having someone before the courts in Portland who's a veteran who wants to go to a treatment program up in Washington, but because of issues around the Interstate Compact for Adult Offenders and the provisions there in transferring someone out of state, there was questions about whether they could do that. One of the things we do a lot of around here is we have work groups. So we brought a group of people together. We expanded the issues. We had a meeting up at the Federal Veterans Administration. Senator Schrader was there. Representative Barker was there. We had 35 people from various agencies, law enforcement, criminal defense bar, the judiciary, Veterans Administration, both federal and state level, congressional offices. And we had a whole series of issues discussed around there. Jess had the bill from last session that would have we will talk about later in greater detail. We identified certain issues to work on. We found that a lot of them were just left hand talking to the right hand. For example, one of them was a simple issue of the DHS realizing that a federal veterans program was a quality program and should be recognized as it relates for DWE diversion. That was fairly simple to do. We then met again at the Anderson Readiness Center in October. We had about 40 people at that meeting. One of the issues raised then, and one of the whole things for this whole process, is identifying veterans early as they come into the system. We heard about the state of Washington's program where they have outreach workers in the jails in their largest counties, and how this significantly reduced the number of veterans who repeat in the criminal justice system. Many of them have mental illness problems. Many of the people with mental illness problems come into contact with the criminal justice system for such issues as criminal trespass. They go into a store repeatedly. They go into and they act out. So they're arrested. They get released. They go back again. This was able to break the cycle. When we met in the Anderson Readiness Center, someone suggested that we have an identification on the license to once again identify. We're working. One of the key components when you come in the criminal justice system is a defense counsel. Many of these people are indigent. They have mental illness problems, many of these veterans. They will be appointed counsel. If the counsel knows there are programs, then he can tie into it. The district attorney can realize that. So can the probation officer and the judge. One of the things Jim Willis is working on is putting together on their webpage a list of all the programs that a veteran is eligible for, be it the state level or be it the federal level, be they just for veterans or be they for the general public, so what a veteran would also be eligible for, so that that attorney or probation officer can click on and find out that information. You'll hear about the diversion bill that we have worked out. Once again, it's to identify and then treat, to keep them out of the criminal justice system. One of the judges I talked to was Judge Ashcroft, who was the Brigadier General in the National Guard and in the JAG program. He's now a judge down in Marion County. When he talked at the bar seminar, he said, "You've got to remember that for someone in the service, an involvement with the criminal justice system very well means the end of their career. Where an involvement with someone in the civilian life, it does not necessarily mean that." Let me give you an example. The Lautenberg Act, the federal gun control law, basically says that if you have a misdemeanor conviction for domestic violence, you can't carry a firearm. Well, that causes problems if you're in the military. And I'm not advocating domestic violence, but that is an issue that comes up a lot when these people come back from service. Mm-hmm. And if they have to redeploy again because their families need the money, and they've gotten in a tiff with their wife and the police get involved, that can cause problems. Senator Boquist mentioned this morning the service can oftentimes deal with these issues better than the civilian part can. Maybe I should get down there and be on the witness stand, I'm not sure. That's a general overview. I have to say that maybe one more meeting of the work group. I think what has to happen informally afterwards is that all these different agencies that were involved and should meet periodically and formally to discuss barriers that come up and work them out. I mean, belabor this point for 1 second longer, going back to the Interstate Compact, Mark Cadot from the Department of Corrections came up to me after a meeting this morning and said, "We're working it out with the state of Washington." So those transfers can go a lot quicker.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think a point from my perspective, and I mean, once you get the importance of having a diversion program in the statute that gives the latitude, officially gives the latitude to the district attorney or the precursor to the criminal justice system, is that it's then formalized, and that's kind of the step and course of action once you're identified.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you what the flip of the coin is, and I'll guarantee you as a commander, absolutely guarantee you this, is if you didn't have a formal diversion program in the state of Oregon, I would tell every single soldier in my command not to sign up and be marked as a veteran. And the reason being is this. Federal government, I've seen it, has already issued to all the law enforcement agencies in the United States letters saying that look out for veterans, they are a risk, and they are a problem. That letter is fact, it's there, seen it, so on and so forth. So as a commander, the last thing I would want to do is tell any of my soldiers, put the stamp on your forehead, which is the importance of you don't get a diversion program that says the latitude's there and this is the benefit, and you know that it's going to be considered. Because I guarantee you, if you have it there, the first thing the defense lawyer is going to say is go to the DA and say, hey, here's the issue, here's the problem, let's deal with it this way. And he's got, and the DA regardless has got, for better word, top cover. But without that, I would tell every single soldier I have not to sign up for the license program. Because you're marked, and it's going to be a problem. And I think I would get probably the support of every veterans group in the state in saying that. They would identify that will be an issue.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for being here today. Really appreciate this. I would urge you to continue your work. I was going to ask a quick question, but why don't, if you're here after the hearing, I'll just catch you outside about some of your programs and how you're working with some of the other partners. But we are going over time, so I'm going to thank you, and I'm also going to thank Mr. Taylor for putting this in context, and thank you, Senator Boquist, because I think you're absolutely correct that these two issues have to be, cannot be decoupled, or we will be in deep trouble, and soldiers will be in deep trouble. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. We did move a little bit into criminal justice and the mental health system. However, I think what we need to do, since Mr. Willis is here, is why don't we skip back to the portion of our agenda where we're going to get some a quick update on a sighting of the veterans home. Excuse me, of a second veterans home, and then we can move back into the rest of our agenda.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to update you on the progress of building a second veterans home in Oregon. As I've reported to you previously, we've completed the federal VA grant process, and our project has been placed on a priority list with the federal VA. Although we were quite far down on that list, projects will move up once a site is selected and the 35% matching funds are secured. I've also reported previously that we've hired a construction manager for the project who's dedicated to overseeing this entire process. We currently are preparing to release a request for proposals seeking a site on which to build the second home. That RFP is currently being reviewed by the Justice Department for legal sufficiency. And once it's released back to us, we'll advertise the RFP, and then our department will also advertise the announcement in private sector media. The RFP itself will be open for 45 days. Following that time, we'll appoint an evaluation committee. They'll review each of the submissions and make a recommendation back to the director. I anticipate the question most often asked is, okay, if you start this RFP process in January, when would you in reality be able to announce a site? I think we can do it by April. And the reason I say that is because the sites in the state that we're aware of that want this veterans home in their jurisdiction have already done their homework. They're ready to go. They're just waiting on the RFP. And they're going to fill in the blanks, and I'll bet you they'll have it back in well before the 45 days. In any event, after that's done, we're going to be concerned with them being able to maintain a sustainable admission rate. so that we can have a good census in that home, the ability to recruit and retain qualified medical staff, and then access to supporting medical facilities, among other criteria. And then I'll announce as director the winning proposal. And certainly I'll report back to both the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees. In the meantime, we'll be submitting more material to the federal government to complete the initial phase of this grant process. We'll update them when the site has been selected, and we will update them when the 35% matching funds have been secured. As these requirements are met, our project moves up the priority list, and we feel very comfortable that the VA will provide its 65% funding for the construction. The time frame for construction will depend upon the funding requirements being met, but I'm hopeful that we will begin construction in 2011 on this home. And just to remind you of the type of facility we're looking at a minimum it will be a 200-bed facility, and it will cost in the neighborhood of $40 million. It will be a large impact on the local economy of wherever it is built, because it's long-term jobs and so on. We've been in the Dalles since 1997. We've provided good living wage jobs for Wasco County and the Dalles, and we'll do the same in this next one, only more jobs because it's a larger facility. And finally, in what I thought was a very good decision by the federal VA, they said that we could take assisted living people, whereas in the past we were only able to take skilled nursing residents and Alzheimer or other dementia. I like the idea a lot, as someone who serves veterans, of someone who qualifies for assisted living coming to a veteran's home, and we also take spouses, as I'm sure you know. So the veteran and their spouse come to assisted living. They can stay as they transition into skilled nursing. They don't have to move. They're at their home, in essence. And then, God forbid, should they suffer any dementia, they can stay there as well. Also, if the veteran were to pass away before the spouse, I'm often asked about the spouse. The bottom line is that's now their home, and they can stay as long as they like. We're very happy about that. And the other thing I'll report on just briefly is that at the Dalles, we also have a construction project ongoing where we're building a multi-purpose room. If we had that project to do over again, we'd have had the multi-purpose room in the beginning, but it wasn't. So we've asked the VA to authorize us to use part of their same funding mechanism, by the way, 35% our funds, 65% theirs. And once this multi-purpose room is built, it will allow us to hold concerts, presentations, interaction with the local community, interaction with veteran service organizations who often want to come to the home and do something for the residents. And currently we have to do it ward by ward because we don't have a large enough facility. We expect that we will begin construction on the multi-purpose room in 2010, and I'll certainly be back to the committee to update you on its completion and, of course, to invite you to its opening when the construction is completed. And so that concludes my testimony on the second veterans home and the update on the multi-purpose room at the existing veterans home.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Willis. Any questions, comments?
Just a comment, Madam Chair. This was an issue that we discussed during the interim, and there is great interest in having a second veterans home in the state of Oregon. And yes, there are places that really want to have this in
yes,
their community.
Yes, yes, Chair Schrader and Senator Mona Sanderson. This might be one of the most interesting decisions of my tenure as the director. It may terminate my tenure. I don't know.
We'll see. We'll go for three, Jim.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Okay,
we'll
good.
We'll introduce a bill
Thank
for three.
Thank you.
There you
Thank
go.
You very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Matt, for being here. And I'll just make a quick comment. As a commissioner, I was often involved with infrastructure sitings, and sometimes they're very interesting processes. So good luck. We'll do what we can to keep you as our director after the process is over. Okay. In any case, let us move back to our agenda. Thank you. We're a little bit more on time now. And we do have invited testimony from folks, veterans in the criminal justice and mental health system. And I would invite the individuals to come up, introduce themselves, and let's get started. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cameron Smith, for the record, and I am the policy advisor for the governor on public safety. I'm taking over for Joe O'Leary as he steps up into the general counsel position. Bill, do you want to give a kickoff, or can we just launch in at all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I already did. I probably got carried away, frankly.
I think you can just continue. I think we put this in some context already.
For what I will testify on here this morning, or this afternoon, sorry, it's been a long day, and I apologize, Senator Boquist will have to listen again to some of the members in the room. For some context in terms, what I will provide is some context in terms of the transition that our veterans make as they come back from war, where the public safety world and the criminal justice system intersect with that, and where are some of the tangible benefits of this discussion that's going on between these two worlds. And as some background on myself, I am a veteran. Full disclosure, I was a Marine officer, active duty for 4 years, dove into the governor's second term, and then was recalled for one last tour, third tour in Iraq. Always in Iraq, never got any variety in my deployed experience. So that kind of underlies my testimony here today. And I truly valued my service as a Marine officer. And what veterans bring back, they can be our best citizens, obviously. And I'm preaching to the choir in terms of the members of this committee. And I thank the legislature and the governor and so many of the agencies, whether the Department of Veterans, the National Guard, huge support in Oregon for veterans, and it's been inspiring. And from my service, I obviously, you capture the benefits of the leadership, the discipline, the values, and we bring that back with us, but we also shoulder a burden that we bring back. We recognize that some of the attitudes and the habits that keep us alive on the battlefields of Iraq or Afghanistan are not always, they don't always translate well back to the States when we come back to our communities. And one of the classic examples for me that I make light of, but kind of shows other serious issues, is on driving. When you're in Iraq, when you're running convoys, going between bases, you often own the roads. And when you come to a traffic jam, it's not just a nuisance, it's a potential danger zone. So you would expect to jump the curb, speed up, accelerate, go into oncoming traffic, go cross country. That's a dynamic that you would reward and appreciate as a life-saving measure in Iraq that obviously does not translate well when I am making the I-5 haul and cutting Senator Boquist off on the freeway and trying to go across the blackberry bushes in the median. And that's just, we make light of that, but it kind of shows at a small level some of the mental health issues, the stresses of war that we bring back are not always translate well to our communities. And when we come back as a unit, there's a reasonably, you have close bonds within that unit. And when you have that kind of process, what the National Guard that's deployed now, what they will fall back in on in terms of the reintegration effort that Director Willis and General Caldwell and all the rest have set up, it's truly inspiring, the support for families, individuals on the financial spectrum, on the mental health spectrum, on fiscal, financial problems that they may be having, and also the employment, getting back into their job. I mean, kind of the host of issues that they're going to get that support on. And that happens on the active duty front, and we had kind of discussions how sometimes it depends on the unit that you're with, how fully developed those programs are. But when you come back, there is a warrior transition phase where you're looking. We're taught to look for individuals if they're quiet or withdrawn. Are they anxious or depressed? Do they have mood swings? Are they abusing alcohol? Are they speeding? Are they driving erratically? Are there relationship problems? So we look to catch that and get them into support and counseling and treatment up front. And one of the challenges is that sometimes the invisible effects of war manifest themselves after you've gotten out of the military, after you're back with your community, and you don't have that close-knit support structure in place. And that's really where the public safety community and the criminal justice system can help play a role in terms of catching, in terms of identifying veterans with issues before they get into further along in the system, catching them early, whether it's a traffic incident, a minor dispute, and then looking where we can get them into the appropriate counseling, treatment, or programs that already exist. And some of what we'll hear today is legislative solutions. Other is just better coordination and communication. And Mr. Bill Taylor has done incredible work getting these two worlds together. And we were kind of we're briefing different committees and different kind of the judiciary side of it, the veteran side of it. And that is going to be going on in the stakeholder process as well, obviously with the DAs, the chief of police, the sheriffs, the probation officers. Where are those points in the criminal justice system where we can guide the veterans in a better path? And obviously, some of the benefits that we can expect. We're keeping veterans where they belong in the asset column for society and not as a liability and a drain on limited resources. And I think we've seen with the Vietnam era veterans, you can pay now or you can pay up front or pay historically over time. And I think we're doing an incredible job now, and we're to be commended, but obviously there's ways to improve. And we're going to try to keep veterans out of our criminal justice system, freeing up both short-term and long-term capacity. And lastly, we're going to try to make best use of our federal dollars that often are funding these veteran programs, either through the VA or the Vet Service Organizations. So that's kind of some of the context briefly, and then I'll turn it over to my cohorts for some more of the specifics.
Welcome again.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, again, I'm Jess Barton, Jesse Barton, and pleased to be speaking to you again today. When we speak in terms of keeping veterans out of the criminal justice system, this whole diversion concept, I mean, the big picture is what we would like to have, I think, are some sorts of what I refer to as multidisciplinary teams that if a veteran gets caught up in the criminal justice system, a team, you know, this team could be accessed to try to determine if this is a proper veteran to be removed from the criminal justice system and put into some kind of program where his whatever it was that got him down this path can be get him back on track and keep him out of the criminal justice system altogether. That's going to take time and money to put those programs together. In fact, we've been working with Oregon Partners in Crisis on just exactly that sort of thing. And there's other organizations I know that are coming together right now to put together those sorts of programs. But one piece of the puzzle is this diversion bill. And the bill that we, after, as Mr. Taylor explained, there's a work group that was formed, has representatives from the Oregon War Veterans Association. I should mention I'm an associate legal counsel as part of my private practice. I'm an associate legal counsel to OWVA. Members from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Oregon District Attorneys Association, Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and then Oregon Partners in Crisis. I went and met with Mr. Taylor three times and came up with this bill, which I want to describe, and hopefully I can do it fairly quickly. The bill we used as a foundation is House Bill 3396 from the last legislative session. It was sponsored by then Representative Shields on behalf of Oregon War Veterans Association and myself. And that bill originally had two provisions, really. I mean, two sections. One section was intended to enhance district attorney diversion authority. And I just want to digress for just a second. We're talking about district attorney diversion authority. It's discretionary. There's not a word in the bill that would require a district attorney to divert a case, but would just authorize him or her to divert a case if they deem it appropriate. The other part of the bill was a bill that would have systematized judicial or judge decisions on when to mitigate sentences, for example, instead of giving somebody prison, giving them probation, that sort of thing. But the work group decided that it would be advantageous to just dispense with the sentencing mitigation piece and go exclusively with the DA discretion piece. And so we then worked from House Bill 3396 provisions on that, made some modifications. One modification we made, probably the first one, is that we would restrict the diversion program to veterans who were, well, I should say, would exclude veterans from the diversion program if they were dishonorably discharged from active duty. But we made sure we did some tightening of the language to ensure that it would apply to any veteran. I mean, there was maybe some problems with the language in the original bill that might have inadvertently excluded some veterans. So it basically will capture all veterans across the board, whether it's active duty, reserve, National Guard, whatever. They all could be captured. The bill will not apply to drunk driving diversion. That's a separate statute, and this bill will have nothing to do with that. If it's a drunk driving case that the veteran's involved in, this bill won't be of any assistance to him. It's all other types of cases besides drunk driving. The diversion statute is ORS 135886, and it sets out a list, and it's a non-exclusive list, but there's a list of 10 factors that district attorneys should consider in deciding whether to divert cases. And the primary one that would come into play in these types of these veteran cases, I think, is the 10th one. It's a mitigating circumstance. So the mitigating circumstance would be in deciding whether to divert a case might be post-traumatic stress disorder after, you know, the third deployment or something like that, or maybe traumatic brain injury, maybe a combination of the two. That's not unusual. And sometimes traumatic brain injury has been misdiagnosed as post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a real problem that the Veterans Administration, for example, the hospitals had to deal with, learning better how to recognize or how to distinguish between PTSD and TBI. Another consideration that DAs take into account deciding whether to divert is number six. It's the impact of diversion upon the community. And this is something that I've been wanting to emphasize now for some time, and that's that the community can be defined in different ways. And one way to define the community is the veterans community. What if you have a veteran who's still in the Guard or still in the reserve? He has a community that's comprised of his military unit. And maybe his military unit needs him. It's going to be deployed again pretty soon. And that unit needs him to go. They don't need him to be back home sitting in jail. They need to have him in Iraq or in Afghanistan where he can do some good and make a difference. And without him there, the community's weakened. That military unit's ability to perform its mission is weakened. And fellow members of that unit, of that community, are at risk if no diversion is done. Now, the persons won't be able to be diverted at all if their crime involves serious physical injury. Now, there's a special definition for that in the Oregon Criminal Code, and typically serious physical injury can lead to a first-degree assault conviction, which is a Measure 11 crime, gets you a 90-month mandatory minimum. If a service member or a veteran committed a crime involving serious physical injury, they could not take advantage of this bill. If they committed a Class A or B felony that involved physical injury, not serious physical injury, but just physical injury. Under the criminal code, there's another definition. Physical injury, you can just sort of imagine it's less serious than serious physical injury. And there's a sort of a hierarchy of injuries that the criminal injury type levels, starting with death and then ratcheting down to harassment, which is just, it's like some sort of just unwanted physical contact. That's the minimum type of physical contact that could lead to a criminal conviction. But if there's just physical injury involved in an A or a B felony, then there would be no diversion allowed under this bill. And then the last thing is the bill. We want the bill to be retroactive to the extent that when the bill takes effect, and let's hope, you know, with the emergency clause, it could take effect in February. And which would be great because we're going to have the 41st Brigade. You know, we talk about how earlier this year, Oregon saw its largest mobilization since World War II. That means that next year Oregon's going to see its largest demobilization since World War II. So it would be good to have this law on the books before that largest demobilization since World War II actually occurs. So we would like to see the bill take effect with an emergency clause and have it be apply retroactively, not to cases where there's been a conviction sustained in some fashion already, but to cases where there's not yet been a conviction at all. The case is still pending in a pretrial status. So if it's pending, there's been a conviction, and the case is awaiting sentencing, that service member would be able to take advantage of the bill, even if just before sentencing, the governor signed the bill into law and it took effect. And that completes my overview of the bill. And again, I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Now, this is Madam Chair, this is an area that's dicey in my book, especially now coming before me, who has no judicial background. I relate to the brain and how the brain works and the reaction and the behaviors. But when you're getting down to law, I'm going to need to be educated. Even the definitions of Class A felony versus B, I mean, this is information that's going to be, you're going to need to educate me.
I told you this morning, that's what we had in judiciary. Joint judiciary, exactly.
And I think that a little bit of familiarity I have, largely that as a commissioner, this was actually part of public safety, was part of the continuum of the work that we did. So I'm familiar with a lot of this because we had to work so closely with our DA and our sheriff and our judges on multiple issues. So, however, I wouldn't mind if we needed to pull together a more detailed briefing just to make sure that we're all on the same page with this. I think it would be wise.
Well, my concern, if we're going to pass this in February, I'm looking at me being educated in January.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in February, we have 2 weeks to get our bills out of this chamber, so I think it's the 11th.
Right.
The bills will have to be out of this chamber so that they can be in the other chamber, and then they'll have 7 days or 8 days to get their bill out. So the more education you can do to us prior to February will at least help me.
And perhaps Mr. Taylor could help us out with that as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the most complex systems in the state of Oregon is our sentencing system. We have what are A, B, and C felonies. We have misdemeanors. And then we have layered on top of that sentencing guidelines, where they take not only the crime that you've committed, which has been weighed by the Criminal Justice Commission, and then factor in your past criminal history. And then we have on top of that Measure 11. In other mandatory sentences passed by the voters. The basic thing on an A felony involving violence would be murder. They're basically Measure 11 offenses, rape one, sodomy one. What is not included in that would be a situation, often many of the drug offenses. Years ago, we classified many of the drug offenses involving sale. Marijuana, heroin, anything like that is Class A felonies and B felonies. We don't rank them quite that high on sentencing guidelines. Sentencing guidelines was basically rank higher crimes involving violence. When we talk about serious physical injury, and Jess is an excellent criminal appellate attorney, we're talking about a broken nose, a busted teeth, a broken jaw. Physical injury is just maybe you can probably explain it better than I can along those lines. But the typical situation would be a Class A misdemeanor assault, where someone comes home, gets in a bar fight, gives someone a black eye. That would be something that would be allowed to be put through a diversion program. If you broke the guy's arm, probably not. But the district attorney can always plea down to a Class A misdemeanor. They have tremendous discretion. Jess, can you help me on this area?
Nope. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a pretty accurate description of a black eye. That would be the sort of a prolonged injury or prolonged impairment that would equal physical injury, just physical injury. And we'll get you a misdemeanor conviction for the Class A misdemeanor of fourth-degree assault. But if you broke the arm, that's a prolonged impairment of the sort that it interferes with your ability to live your life in the normal sense that you expect to be able to live your life. You have a broken arm, and that equates to serious physical injury. If it's done intentionally, then it's a first-degree assault, and that's a Measure 11 crime, carries a 90-month minimum. But really briefly, I apologize. Mr. Taylor is absolutely correct. One of the most complicated areas of law in this state is sentencing. It's very complicated. And Mr. Taylor ticked off a bunch of different sentencing schemes or systems we have in this state. He didn't get them all, believe me. There's like five or six or seven or eight more. And, you know, if you like try, you can't even do an overlay of them. But anyway, but the basic thing is that, with you know, we rank our crimes A, B, C, felony. And we, well, what does that really mean? Well, what it really means is, what's the maximum sentence? So an A felony, the maximum is 20 years. B, it's 10 years. C, it's 5 years. And then you go into misdemeanors. And those, again, are A, B, C. And their maximums are 1 year, 6 months, 30 days. So, yeah. But then, you know, murder's up there, and you got aggravated murder, and you get death for that. So you got to think about that. And there's dangerous offender sentencing, and then you got the guidelines over here, and the repeat property offender law, and the repeat methyl. It just goes on and on. And, but we can.
Maybe we should let the district attorney talk. And the reason being is they already have this authority now. They can do it now. The only difference is this, for better word, my word here, is this puts it in statute and gives them top cover. And then they can turn around and say, there are these resources out here that we can address this issue with. So it's not really changing the practice we have now, but keep in mind, those district attorneys are elected like we are. And so they need to have a little bit more comfort in a formalized system that they can, at their discretion, use. Because it's purely their discretion. Either way, it's their discretion.
Now?
Yes. Okay.
You're on.
Good afternoon, Chair Schrader, members of the committee, Senator Boquist. Nice to see you again, Bill. It's becoming really a regular thing here. My name is Elizabeth Kushwan. Today I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The first thing I'd like to do is thank Bill for convening this committee. We worked with OCDLA and the War Veterans. We worked with Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and the Partners in Crisis. I have to say it was, I think, one of the easier things we've done. Everyone seemed to be very much on task in wanting to help veterans. I will make one little adjustment to what Senator Boquist said, and actually, well, district attorneys do have diversion and use it for cases like Dewey, driving under the influence of intoxicants. What it hasn't included until now is this concept of physical injury. Physical injury has never been allowed in a diversion. Diversions were designed to be one-time quick fixes, to intervene quickly and to change someone's behavior so they don't get marked forever. And that makes a lot of sense in this case. The reason that district attorneys agreed to some sort of physical injury, and this will be where the discretion will be used, I would guess primarily, is because these people have been trained for physical responses. Candidly, you know, somebody turns around and gets you on the back of the shoulder, you turn around and pop them. Well, that's great, but if you're on the corner bar having a beer after work and you turn around and pop them, it's a different situation. And so to bring it back to, I think, something that's going to be more likely to occur, that to me is going to be the scenario more often than not. And then there will be the ability to put these veterans into programs available in the community. And so that will not be standardized, because that's going to be what's available where you live. What you have in Tillamook is not what you're going to have in Portland. It's a bit different. But there are resources in every community to do this. And so we're very pleased to be part of this. And I think that it's something that will help our returning veterans. The district attorneys were very pleased to do this. And Senator Monis Anderson, Senator Boquist, Senator Schrader, I'll be happy to have each of your district attorneys call you and spin you up a little bit.
Mine was here this morning. What are you talking about?
Or your many district attorneys, Senator Boquist, the many district attorneys you represent. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The reason I like this concept is, if we could develop a really great model within the veteran community, think what we could do then in the regular community, because we have people getting into the correction system who have been in very, very severe traumatic situations just within their family or community. So I think this is a great concept.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think that makes an excellent point, and in my mind it does kind of link to what we do on the juvenile side of the house, where you often are trying to divert at the initial stages when it most makes sense. One thing that I think will provide some comfort for yourself is that we will have the legal eagles on the Senate Judiciary and the House Judiciary Committee looking at this. Some of the nature of this cross-cutting discussion is one committee doesn't always have the expertise, and where Judiciary doesn't always have the expertise in what a veteran service officer is, what are some of the VA programs that we hear so much about on this committee, and then they have all of that background on the criminal charges and that expertise. One point that I didn't make earlier is also growing out of this discussion has been sometimes, you know, whether it's a traffic incident, a minor dispute, booking into jail, it doesn't always come, you know, I don't have a short haircut anymore. I sometimes slip into the military lingo, but nothing identifies me as a veteran up front. And one thing that can help is in terms of the driver's license as an identification. It's come up historically, and I think it will come up again potentially through this committee. Could you have some mark or notation on the back of a license that I could self-identify as a veteran, bring my DD-214 honorable discharge paper down to the DMV, not only get a honorary license plate, but also have a little check mark on the back of my license that says, similar to the organ donor designation or which class vehicle I can drive. And there's some issues of how we actually do that mechanically, and we'll be widening this conversation to DMV and ODOT and seeing what's realistic. But that could be, you know, you get your license for some retired or for some full-time active duty, you have a card, but once you do your 4 years and you're back out, you don't always have something that kind of shows you're a veteran, and that would pop quickly for law enforcement or the sheriffs or the jails. That would actually then be able to shift that discussion by 3 days in when the defense attorney kind of gets it out of them, hey, I'm a veteran, could be an option. So that will be part of the conversation as well.
Well, thank you for this, and I think this illustrates the fact that veterans' issues oftentimes have been under the umbrella. I had a conversation with Mr. Warnock actually earlier today, and that there seems to be folks are happy that the veterans, that there seems to be a single committee, because the issues they're facing, as you say, cross multiple domains. I mean, judiciary, public safety, that whole thing. So this is kind of an interesting exercise as well in breaking down silos and how we operate and work with groups of, you know, our veteran population. So I actually, hopefully, this will inform other ways of breaking down silos long term as we work together. So, thank you for being here today, and you got us right back on time. In fact, I think we're ahead of time, are we not?
Can't fix the house.
Madam Chairman, as a committee, we still have Alon Lambert for the Oregon Partners in Crisis and regional meetings, and then we have Leah Kraft who'll be here for Richard Harris.
Okay, let's call them up. And we are still running on time, so thank you for being here.
Yes. Chair Schrader and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alon Lambert. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Partners in Crisis, which is headquartered here in Salem. I'm also the volunteer chair of the Veterans Mental Health Advocacy Council for the Portland VA Hospital. And I'm a member of the new legislative task force on women veterans health care. I am a Vietnam-era veteran, and I really like to thank you for inviting me here today and also for all the work that you're doing for veterans. And as has been stated, and as you know, the wars in Afghanistan are a record of the longest combat operation since Vietnam. And again, what we know from the mental health side also is that the multiple deployments are taking a toll on the veterans and their families. And I think one of the things that we really have to keep in mind with this is the family and the children. And so what happens is the risk for family conflict, for violence, sexual assault, substance abuse, and many other consequences for veterans and their communities come out of the stress and this PTSD. And the last number that I was told is that there's an expectation of about 40% of those returning vets will have a diagnosis of some form of a mental disorder. One of the things that's also happening, and you may have seen it or read it, is that the last statistic I saw was that of the across the United States, there have now been 122 Iraq or Afghanistan veterans who have committed murder. And recently there was one in John Day. So the issue is very, very much needed to be addressed. And I would just like to call your attention to the first sheet, first group of papers you have is actually my testimony, which I'm going to be a very short version of. But something I want to read is a short quote from Lee Berkin's book, Soldier's Heart. It says, "The stress and traumas of war are unpredictable in their assault upon the human body, mind, and spirit. No one other than the combatants who directly experience the insane obscenities of warfare can comprehend the nature of the wounds. Every war fought still reverberates in the body, mind, and soul of the soldiers who faced death and killed and battled to keep themselves and friends alive." I can tell you as a former wife of a Vietnam veteran who in his job in the military had to kill many people, we had it at home much of the time. And so it was very difficult. But what Partners in Crisis is about is bringing together law enforcement, criminal justice, and mental health. And Partners in Crisis has been going about since 2004 when it was actually originated under NAMI Oregon, National Alliance of Mental Illness Oregon. And then I was the interim executive director for NAMI Oregon in 2007. I kept saying, what is this Partners in Crisis? And realized that it needed to be its own 501c3. And so we moved it out. And I was originally on the board in moving it out, and now I'm the executive director. But how I've gotten involved in this idea of the jail diversion for veterans is in 2008, Addictions and Mental Health actually contracted with me to respond to a SAMHSA grant, federal grant, on jail diversion and trauma recovery with priority to veterans. When they hired me to do this, we did not realize that we didn't have enough time to actually complete the grant. But to the credit of Addictions and Mental Health, what we began to look at is what is required. If we'd gotten the money for this grant, what was required in it, one of which was to hold stakeholder meetings around the state to really identify stakeholders, have them meeting, and then also to create pilot programs that would be funded. So the AMH contracted with me then to start identifying stakeholders around the state, which I did for a period of a year. And what I found was that each time I was talking to different people, I would say, you know, if you could sit with so-and-so that I just talked to, I know that we could find some answers without spending money to some of these issues. So when I was talking to retired Sheriff Raul Ramirez, who at that time was the president or the executive director of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, it's like, you know, why are you not in on the discussions with jail diversion with addictions and mental health, and why is not Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, which is actually on the next corner, not at these meetings? And so we began to pull more and more people together. Ramirez held a meeting at which Colonel McRae from the National Guard was there, and we had representation from Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, Yamhill County Sheriff Jack Crabtree was there. There were a number of people were there. And out of that meeting, then got a hold of Jack Himes from the VA, and Jack convened a law enforcement summit at the VA, where we had 22 people, and the Ashland Police Department were actually on that video conference. And as people began to introduce themselves and talk about their part of it, we began to realize that there were things that were coming up that could be handled. And six things came out of that which cost no money. The first one was to realize that the VA substance abuse treatment program was not, as I put it, was not blessed by DHS or Addictions and Mental Health. So they could not send someone through that program because it was not going to be credited. So that issue is now being taken care of. We came up with the what happens if a sheriff's deputy or a police officer picks up someone who is a vet after hours, what do they do? Well, the chief of police for the Veterans Hospital was there. Most people don't know that the VA hospital has its own police department. And so the chief of police was there. So he's saying, that's my job. So you could see as people came together that were heads of agencies of department, Joe Willis was there. We had, again, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Association of Community Mental Health Programs, Portland Police, numerous sheriffs, Tillamook County, quite a few people anyway. And out of that, started working on things that could happen. And then in Tillamook County, after that meeting, there was a veteran who was definitely harmed himself or others. He had killed his dog and burned it. And then Sheriff Todd Anderson actually got involved in that case. And he had just become, or he was the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, so he was part of all these meetings. And the things that we thought could work ended up that veteran did not get put into the Portland treatment program or on the psychiatric ward. So that was the time that because of jurisdiction issues and some other things, so that was when Jack Himes contacted Bill Taylor and all of the rest of that began to happen. So part of my contract with Addictions and Mental Health was the last piece of it was to actually write a grant to get funded to hold state regional stakeholder meetings around the state regarding jail diversion for veterans. I wrote that grant, I got it funded, and it was supposed to be done through Partners in Crisis, which it is. I have the money in the bank. We are holding, originally it was going to be 4, then it went to 6, and now it's at 9. Stakeholder meetings around the state, which will be the Portland area, which will hold it at the Tigard Armory. And then we will have Salem and Eugene, Roseburg, Medford, Bend, LeGrand, Ontario, and Pendleton. And what we're doing is bringing together all the stakeholders, the DAs, the judges, the defense attorneys, the VA, the ODVA, County Veterans Service Officers, commissioners, legislators, everyone, veterans, family members, who can come together and talk about the issues. We'll first educate people on the issues of returning veterans. Second, we will break down by counties and areas so that we can find out what is happening now in those areas regarding treatment for veterans and what are the issues, and then look at solutions. And one of the things, as I shared this morning, a Judiciary Committee, is that I'm actually making up a deck of cards that has all those different players in it, and we're going to lay them out for each of the regions about how they work now, and then we're going to have an idea of picking them up and saying, okay, how could it work? And again, it's about not having more money. It's about who is there now. Jess talked about the multidisciplinary teams. That's what we came up with, is the idea of who could wrap around a veteran if they were arrested. How could we get them treatment? Part of what I have in your packet is, on the right-hand side, is it's a better way of programs offering alternatives to incarceration and tells about all the different ways. And one of those is, of course, the CIT trainings. I've been charged to get the veterans issues before all the CIT trainings in the state of Oregon. The VA is putting together a DVD. They're going to hold it, train the trainers, and then to get it in there. So that will be before a training. And the idea is on train the trainers is to get a person, an officer who is a veteran, to be able to teach that in their particular area, so that they understand the issues. I personally am CIT trained. I was trained through Marion County. And so the idea is to do these. The other thing is that this grant that I talked about is comes around every year. And so it is a sheet of paper on the left-hand side, the SAMHSA news release, that talks about this grant. It is $394,000 each year for up to 5 years. So you're talking just short of $2 million. And the continuation of after the first year is if you meet the requirements. But it is for jail diversion and trauma recovery priority to veterans. The other thing is that we talked about General Shinseki's idea of the homelessness being taken care of. There probably is money there that can be applied for through the homelessness that would affect also all of these issues. So Addictions and Mental Health has agreed to file the for the grant this time. It has to be done through them. It can't be done through any other place. The idea is that we are talking about hopefully that these can continue outside of the idea of veterans, that Partners in Crisis is actually, that's what we're about. And we're setting up all of these regions and then wanting to continue the Partners in Crisis meetings in all of these regions to exactly address the issues for mental health, criminal justice, and law enforcement as a continuation of the work that we've been doing.
Thank you so much. I believe we met at that meeting, if
we
I'm
did.
Not mistaken. I do
yes.
remember. And it's nice to, see you again, and thank you for coming with your testimony today.
Thank you.
Okay. And we have...
Good afternoon, Chair Schrader, members of the committee. My name is Leah Kraft, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Manager for Addictions and Mental Health at the Department of Human Services. And I want to thank you for including us in this discussion, not only today, but also over the past few months. There have been a handful of issues surrounding veterans and the mental health services that we provide throughout the state that I feel that we've been working pretty effectively on collaborating with different agencies statewide and through our counties to be able to kind of problem solve some of these issues. We have been asked to find a point person within our division to kind of help problem solve as issues are occurring and come up. And the Assistant Director, Richard Harris, has asked me to be that point person, which I am happy to do, and to continue these discussions as they arise. And one of the things that I am also looking into and discussed this morning was, you know, applying for the SAMHSA grant and making sure that we proceed with that as effective as we can and work in collaboration with the Oregon Partners in Crisis and others at the table. So I just really wanted to come and just reiterate our commitment to working through these issues. I'm sure, as you know, in our mental health capacity, we're only funded to reach about 46% of the population with mental health issues, and addictions is much lower at about 24%. So while we don't have resources, we are committed to doing what we can with what we have available. And thank you.
I would just like to thank DHS for stepping up to the plate for this, because one of the things that the agencies will be receiving a letter from Representative Cowan and myself really outlining that our expectation is, again, across the continuum of services to veterans at every agency in one form or another, mm-hmm. where it's appropriate in their capacity, step up to the plate and actually be part of the systems wide approach that we want to take in the state. There are things that the Department of Revenue should be doing. We've heard DMV, you know, and again, if we can move ahead with this particular bill with voluntary identification, that's another different department. You, obviously, the Department of Human Services is a natural, and I'm sure that as we move on and move forward, we're going to find other agencies in the state where we can be very creative, break down the silos, and get them to be a part of this continuum of care. And let me also acknowledge, I know that there is resource scarcity out there. And I think that I can speak for myself and my colleagues that we recognize that, but we know that we have good people working for our agencies. We have good people that care about our citizens mm-hmm. and our veterans, and that despite that, you will continue to step up to the plate for them. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your testimony. And colleagues, I'm waxing way too eloquent here. Have you got anything to add?
Madam Chair, may I add a couple
absolutely.
More things? One, General Caldwell has given permission to the reintegration team that we are actually partnering with them to do these regional meetings. There, as far as resources, there is a mobile van for regional or rural mental health for veterans that happens to be sitting. It's been sitting since February. It was really originally in Eugene. It's now in Salem. If it's to be used for rural, it should be in Bend. To be doing that. So, and Partners in Crisis is willing to be the forum to help all of these things come together. So we're ready to help it any way we can.
Okay. Great. Well, we'll
thank
get
you
statewide for sure. So.
Thanks.
Colleagues, any questions? Okay. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
And now, Mr. Taylor, I do believe we are on the home stretch.
Sure,
Ms.
Queen, I think we don't we have reports?
And I right. Have, this we're on the, what I have here is a transportation report, Senate Bill 98. Are we looking? Are we on the same page here?
That's correct, Madam Chair, members of the committee. These right here.
Mm-hmm. Right, those three
and
Senate Bill 78.
These are the people, I believe. I got this email just today from Tom Mann about the people that are going to be addressing these issues. And maybe that would be Jim Willis, House, Val Conley, and is it
Michael Wood?
Okay.
Michael Wood? Great. Again, these are three bills, Senate Bill 98.
That's right, come on down.
House Bill 2718, which is women's health care, veterans health care for women, and then HB 3104, which is the Veterans Affairs Outreach. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Whoever would like to go first, and
Jim, you're going to do the introductions, or?
Well, yeah,
or
yeah,
you
want to do that. Basically, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The three task forces that came as a result, I think I talked about them a little earlier today. We've already pretty much talked about the reintegration task force, and it's had a meeting, has another meeting coming up. So this afternoon, what we're going to do is brief you on the Veterans Transportation Task Force, which is what Michael Ward is here to talk about. He's with the Oregon Department of Transportation and chairs that task force. And then we'll talk about the Women's Health Care Task Force. And Val Connolly, who is the administrator of our Veterans Services Division at ODVA, is a member of that task force. She's going to provide the update on their work. And then I'll close out with our work on House Bill 3104, which is the outreach effort that hooks all state agencies with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. So, Madam Chair, with your permission, we'll start with Michael with the Transportation Task Force.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michael Ward. I'm the administrator of the Public Transit Division of ODOT. And when I'm before a committee, that's usually the role I'm in, but not today. Today I have the privilege of being here in front of you as the chair of the Veterans Task Force on Transportation. And I do acknowledge how the value the committee places on brevity. So I'll be brief. Senate Bill 98 was passed by the 2009 legislature. Senate Bill 98 created the task force. And in my written testimony, I've actually quoted from the bill as to what the purpose of the task force is. But let me tell you in my own words what I believe the purpose is. And that's for us to, or for the task force, to find those barriers are getting in the way of our veterans receiving the transportation they need and deserve, and then finding ways to break those barriers down. The bill also specifies various members of the committee. I'm obviously the representative from ODOT, but we have representatives from DHS and employment. General Caldwell represents the military department. Jim's on the committee. And we've also gathered a group of advocates, veterans advocates to the committee, as well as some public transit providers. So we have a really good core group of folks, energetic, willing to get started, and we've had one meeting. Our second meeting is scheduled for November 30th. They are anxious and willing to get ready to get their roll up their sleeves and get into trying to find some of these problems. And I look forward to coming back to this committee when I can talk a little more about some of the positive progress we will have made. So with that, I'll end my testimony and take questions probably at the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and member of the Women Veterans Healthcare Task Force. We've had the opportunity to meet twice, so we're very early in this process, but we have some very dynamic people on this particular task force, Senator Manus Anderson included. Our first meeting was just basically introductory, determining what our mission was and the goals to get to that mission. This last meeting on Monday, Dr. Marsha Hall, who is the Women Veterans Program Manager at the VA Medical Center in Roseburg,
presented on women's health and the challenges that she has at the Roseburg Medical Facility. Another member of our committee is Sonia Fry, who is a social worker at the Eugene Outpatient Clinic of the VA. She's got a caseload of over 100, I believe over 100 women that she counsels due to military sexual trauma. So a huge, one of the biggest gaps that we found to date, and we all knew this, is a lack of providers in the system. Fortunately, within the VA, they've recognized...
Excuse me, Madam Chair, that deal with women's issues. Well, lack of providers, but especially those...
Especially
who-
those that deal with women's health issues, mm-hmm. Yes. Fortunately, the VA is stepping up now. They realize that all these women, veterans that are coming home, require care that hasn't been typically needed within the VA healthcare system, particularly with women's reproductive health. So they are taking steps to fill those needs. One of the steps they've taken is that the women program managers that they have at all the VA medical centers, it used to be a collateral duty, they have made that their primary duty, so that they can focus on women veterans' health care. So this committee looks forward to finding any gaps that there are and determining what steps we can take at the local, state, and federal levels to fill those gaps in conjunction with women's health care.
I really want to thank you and Senator Mona Sanderson for working on this issue. I, for the record, I'd like to state I'm serving on the Oregon Women's Commission, and in that capacity, I have brought it to their attention that, again, they're finding out that how women are experiencing PTSD, military sexual trauma, and other health issues actually are different. And they're having specific needs. My understanding is that the VA, and I'll ask this question, is going to be opening up a center in Portland dealing specifically with women's health issues. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. However,
okay,
you have to have providers there, and
so
that's one thing that they don't have at this point. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they will.
Okay.
When they open the center, because we're making more and more veterans, we have more and more women veterans coming home, and so more women use VA facilities than men do, especially our recent returning veterans.
And with your permission, I would like to. I am going to a commission meeting tomorrow. They wanted me to, you know, bring up this issue one more time and do a report. And the piece of spaghetti I'm going to throw on the wall here is I'm wondering if there's an opportunity for the Oregon Women's Commission to get a briefing from this group directly, attend a meeting, or just see if that leads somewhere. I think the commission is looking for some very significant substantive issues to work on and bring to the forefront, and this seems to be a natural to me. Obviously, I'm not asking for a decision, but I'm just throwing it out there as a possibility that perhaps we can talk about outside of this hearing today. So yeah. I just wanted to,
Madam Chair,
see if
that's
that might
absolutely possible.
Okay,
yes, we'd be happy,
Madam
to.
Madam Chair, I think what just blew me away was the figure that 80% of the women, and I think we now have 25% women in the military now. I think, or it's
15%.
50% of the
15%.
15. Okay, I thought. Okay, but 80% of the women have experienced physical abuse or sexual abuse or harassment. And so I think it's we need to just be aware of that so that we can deal with that, especially with the veterans when they are back home. And the fact that between 15 and I think it was 25% have actually experienced rape. So those are just statistics that I said, wow. And those are issues that we really need to pay attention to.
Thank you. Mr. Willis, it's back to you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Willis, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here to report on House Bill 3104, which, for lack of a better term, is our statewide state agency outreach bill. Basically, what we're doing is partnering with all of our other state agencies to identify those veterans who have not been contacted about their benefits either by the State Department of Veterans Affairs or the federal VA. We have many points of contact within state government where we have an opportunity to give these people information about their benefits and how to contact a veteran service officer. And so as a result, we're using several different methods. So I'll just tell you very quickly what they are. One of them is the publication of well over 100,000 contact cards. These cards are ordered by the agencies based on their customer contact. And I'll give you an example. DMV wants 50,000 of those cards. That's understandable given their rate of contact. And I'll throw in a little plug for the veteran designation on the license plate, on the driver's license. If that were to occur, that is the optimum opportunity to ship that driver's license information so that we know who these new veterans are that are either new or not reported. Because in the state of Utah, when they got that partnership going with their state DMV, they identified 7,000 veterans in the state of Utah that they had never contacted. And they were able to send them an information piece and enroll them in their system. So there's just one point, is DMV. But right now they're ordering these 50,000 cards. All these cards go into effect in January of 2010. And it's down to as small as a place like, believe it or not, the State Library, who wants 250. So it's depending on what your size of your clientele is, I guess. We got an order today from DHS for 10,000, which doesn't surprise me. Dr. Goldberg, in his director's message, was focused completely on veteran services and how DHS staff, every employee gets this message, can assist their veteran clients in referring them to us and others for assistance. And just a couple days ago, Brad Ivakian, who many of you know, the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, also put out a director's message talking about the protections that BOLI offers to service members who feel they've been discriminated against with regard to employment opportunities and other things over which his agency has jurisdiction. My point in telling you this is that we've had great cooperation through my fellow state agency heads in a willingness to meet with these Oregon citizens as customers and then find out which of them are willing to self-disclose as veterans so that we can help them. And the really good one happened yesterday when I met with Director Elizabeth Harshenko, who has revenue, who pretty much touches every Oregon family. They decided that they would
pretty
put...
Pretty much does, okay.
Yes, sir. touches might be might be the wrong term to use. Touches, did I say touch?
Yes.
Has contact with. And they put our website information and our logo on every Oregon tax return booklet. So that's going to have a huge impact. And that was something they came up with because in this bill, it allows the agency to, working with us, determine what's the best methodology for us to get these veterans to the state, knowing that of the 341,000, we've only contacted like 80,000 and got them enrolled in health care and benefits and others. So there's a whole bunch of people out there and dependents and survivors who, no matter how hard we try, no matter what website we do, no matter how much television we do, no matter how many public appearances, It's like when I was in the military, there's somebody that always doesn't get the word. And when the formation forms up, there's 49 people, and there's one guy over there who isn't even dressed yet. So that happens. I'm just telling you, I was there. So I'm very excited about the cooperation we're getting from everybody. I know we're going to get new veterans, and here's the good news. When we ask them to put our website on their website, so if you go to a state agency, you're going to see a little Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs logo and our little red, white, and blue marking and so on. You can click at ODOT as an example, and the next thing you're on is our website. So since July, we've gotten 900 hits on that website, which are people we didn't know. So just that one tool, plus all these cards, plus all these personal contacts, and these director messages are going to help. And then I promised, as far as the criminal justice folks, that I would mention the website redesign that we're doing. What we're doing is we're going to put specific tabs and links, very easy to navigate on our website, that are for criminal justice practitioners and mental health people. It says, okay, if you need to know who's got what services, click on this tab, and there's going to be a list of services and also links that'll put you right into their website that says, okay, here's the people working with us on veterans who are being challenged within the criminal justice system, and we're looking for diversion, we're looking for treatment programs, and so on. So what it's resulted in is that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is dealing with non-traditional partnerships and informational resources that we've never used before. And I think the winner, and it should be because it's our mission, the winner at the end of the day is going to be the veteran, their family, and their survivors. And I'm very excited about this. So I think we're meeting the spirit and intent of House Bill 3104. There's always more we can be doing. And some of these really great ideas about how to contact are coming from these non-traditional partners. You wouldn't think you'd go to the state pharmacist for a really great idea about veterans, but they gave us one. And the Oregon Racing Commission is another one. So we've got partners all over the place out there, and they're willing to help us, not only with our young people deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq with the Guard, but also with our active duty home of record Oregonians that are coming home having completed an active duty tour or a career. So that's my story, Madam Chair, and I'm sticking to it.
Yes,
I just have one point, which is a comment, and I mean, Jim doesn't need to respond to it, but okay. I mean, we started down this road three terms ago, and at some point we need to kind of go back and look and see how well we've done, but the issue I raise up is that we have found that every time we get, and we saw the statistics starting out, every time we get somebody in contact with Veteran Services, they're generally eligible for some sort of federal fund. And we calculated, remember, Jim, what, 6 years ago, that there was billions, and I mean billions, of dollars available to divert state resources. People are getting state support to the veterans' federal programs, and then we could take those funds to help other citizens. So every time we help a veteran, we're actually helping every other taxpayer in the state of Oregon. Because by getting them in those federal programs, because most people don't know it, we free up dollars at DHS, criminal justice, every place else, we free up money to help the other citizens with. And, Mr. Governor, I do agree on one thing. We should get every dime from the VA and the feds we should on this.
Absolutely. Senator Mosen, do you have any? Well, you got us through the day, ladies and gentlemen, and or the afternoon. And I just, the last comment I would make is thanks to all your efforts, I think Oregon is truly moving forward with being the welcome home state. That's the brand I always use because I think that that's what our goal and our mission is. And it sounds like we're well on our way with good policy issues that we will work very hard to pass during the February session, as well as the innovation in breaking down the silos between agencies where you may not think that there's a connection, but you can guarantee if you just take a look at it, you can pull that string and you can find the connection. It's very innovative. I would really like to move us forward and be the best in the nation. I already think we're there. We just need to let D.C. know
were there, and we need to push our delegation, and we need to. I know a particular person in the delegation who I will continue to push.
We're not pushing our delegation, Madam Chair. Well, I mean, that's a leadership there.
Push, move them, make them listen, as well as the federal folks, with everything from Department of Labor to the new innovations that are hopefully going to happen with homelessness, you know, that we can partner with. So.
Well, Madam Chair, as I said, I'm going to be meeting just in a very few days with Secretary Shinseki, and they invited six state directors to that meeting, so I felt very fortunate to get an invitation. But I think that's due in part to the things we are doing here.
Thank you.
And so I'm going to say we can do more, but we need your help. And if we're going to do some of the things that you either should be doing or could be doing, if you'll do a little pass-through here, we'll get that taken care of. and I think he'll do it.
Oh, I think
he will. I really do. I don't need to do a commercial for Secretary Shinseki, but somebody asked me, how well do you think this fellow will do? And I'm going to tell you, if you can run the big green army, you can run the federal VA, especially given the fact that he's a disabled veteran and he was a customer of the VA before he was the secretary. And I am very encouraged by his early appointments and by the energy level that's occurring in central office in D.C. Without being critical of previous administrations. I'm just telling you, what's there now are people that get stuff done. They've got Iraq vets in place, so they know the current theater. And they've got some very strong academic people in place that are thinking out of the box. And really good on women's veterans health care. They're finally understanding that in what was a male-centric operation, they've got to deal realistically with things, little things like when a single mother veteran comes for treatment at a VA medical center, it's okay to have child care there. And they haven't done that in the past, but they're doing it now. I think it's great stuff. So I'm encouraged. We'll see. The jury's still out, but we'll see.
I think we'll do. When are you going to D.C.? Or is he coming
10th,
here?
I'm going the 9th of December, the meeting on the 10th.
Well, I may see you there. So
well, good. You can come and help me get a check.
Okay. Well, with that hopeful message, we will adjourn, and I really want to thank my colleagues. Thank you. You're both so wonderful to work with. And, Bill, you do it. You're just, man, you're one of the best administrators I've ever worked with.
I've worked with
some good ones.
Well, thanks.
They're all good.
You're
we're
right
all
up
work
there. Yeah.
This is an interesting issue. It's a good issue.
Yeah.
And for some of you don't know, my daughter attends the U.S. Naval Academy, and where it's 80-20, and I want to tell you, being outnumbered is not always all bad. Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, and I've got a nephew at West Point.
Okay.
So with that, we're adjourned.
Okay.